Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And welcome, my friends, Earth Explorers from all around the world, September 25th, 2011. Yes, we are live tonight, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. Our AccuWindow forecast, hot and humid tonight outside. I guess fall has not taken us in full grips just yet. The solar wind tonight, 336 kilometers per second, but the proton count is way up to 3.4 protons per cubic centimeter. So not that many of you would be out there tonight or right now taking sunbathing, but you just might want to take note of that. Having already unleashed two X flares since September 22nd, just 3 days ago, sunspot 1302 appears ready for more. This complex is huge. The active region has a complex beta-gamma-delta magnetic field that harbors energy for strong M and X-class flare eruptions. Flares from 1302 will become increasingly geo-effective as the sunspot turns toward Earth in just a few days. A pair of closely spaced coronal mass ejections propelled by explosions of sunspot 1302 on September 24th, that was yesterday, are heading not quite directly toward Earth. It's going to be a glancing blow to our planet's magnetic field. Tomorrow, about 1400 UT, that's plus or minus 7 hours, depends on how fast this thing is traveling through space, the NOAA forecasters estimate a 30% chance of strong geomagnetic storms when the clouds arrive. Now, these X-class flares can be pesky in that they jump onto the power grid and can cause problems, especially with sensitive electronics. Tonight, we do have a guest in about 30 minutes. We have L.A. Marzulli coming on. We're going to be discussing his two most recent films, The Watchers and The Watchers 2. So if you have friends out there that are not tuned in that you want to listen to L.A. Marzulli, please give them a call. Tell them at 5:30 Pacific time. That's a half an hour from now. He's going to be coming on. We want you to join the program tonight. You can call us toll-free from just about anywhere in the listening area, which would be all of North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And if you're outside the United States or off-planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-413-4511. And if you want to be one of those well-informed walking around the mall with a informed look on your face, you can call us with your cell phone and listen via Bluetooth on our conference line. Now, you won't be able to participate, but you will be able to listen. It's 760-569-7676. And you'll have to dial the passcode 192919#. When you do, you'll hear the show live on your cell phone, and it's a pretty good sound. So don't forget, 5:30 Pacific time, 8:30 Eastern, we have L.A. Marzulli coming on the program. In the meantime, I want to cover a little bit of news. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about drones and the fact that there was a up-and-coming business of drone-killing drones. And if you really wanted to get ahead of the wave, you'd get a drone-killing drone. Well, one afternoon last fall at Fort Benning, Georgia, two model-sized planes took off, climbed to 800 and 1,000 feet, and began crisscrossing the military base in search of an orange, green, and blue tarp. The automated, unpiloted planes worked on their own, with no human guidance, no hand on any control. Set it and forget it. After 20 minutes, one of the aircraft carrying a computer that processed images from an onboard camera zeroed in on the tarp and contacted the second plane, which flew nearby and used its own sensors to examine the colorful object. Then one of the aircraft signaled to an unmanned car on the ground so it could take a final close-up look. Did you get that? An unmanned car. Yes, they have cars that can drive maps by GPS, and they can even correct themselves for things that might be blocking the road. They can recorrect and choose another path, and they can do it at about 60 miles an hour, much faster than a human driver. Message comes back, target confirmed. This successful exercise in autonomous robotics could presage the future of the American way of war, a la Cyberdyne Systems, a day when drones hunt, identify, and kill the enemy based on calculations made by software, not decisions made by humans. Imagine aerial terminators minus beefcake and time travel. Fort Benning's tarp is a rather simple target, but think of it as a surrogate, said Charles E. Pippin, a scientist at the Georgia Tech Research Institute, which developed the software to run the demonstration. You can imagine real-time scenarios where you have 10 of these things up in the air and something is happening on the ground and you don't have time for a human to say, I need you to do these tasks. It needs to happen faster than that. We will have drones dogfighting and strafing and launching missiles and jamming radar and laying down smoke screens and flares and anti-missile missile defense systems, all at the speed of computers in the air. The battlefield is going to get interesting, very interesting. Hopefully, it'll just be drones killing drones and not drones killing people. So you see, the news is getting kind of interesting out there, at least as far as military technologies. The science fiction is not so far away. However, authorizing machine to make lethal combat decisions is contingent upon political and military leaders resolving legal and ethical questions. Oh, I think those questions have already been answered. We've already seen drones carry out numerous assassinations in the last few years, and not just from the U.S. He goes on to say these include the appropriateness of machines having this ability, under what circumstances it should be employed, where responsibility for mistakes lies, and what limitations should be placed upon the autonomy of such systems. Very soon we will have computers that are faster than the human brain. We will have computers that can reason, that can use a set of decision-making criteria laid down in statute by law, and make decisions, cold, calculated decisions, at the speed of light, and carry them out. In the future, micro-drones will reconnoiter tunnels and buildings, robotic mules will haul equipment, and mobile systems will retrieve the wounded while under fire. Technology will save lives, but the trajectory of military research has led to calls for an arms control regime to forestall any possibility that autonomous systems could target humans. In Berlin last year, a group of robotic engineers, philosophers, and human rights activists formed the International Committee for Robot Arms Control and said such technologies might tempt policymakers to think war can be less bloody. Also reasons why those in the Air Force never really had the memories from war that infantry did because they were above the clouds, they were looking through an eyepiece, they were looking at the effectiveness of ordnance, but hardly looking at the ground. Some experts also worry that hostile states or terrorist organizations could hack robotic systems and redirect them, oh, most certainly. Malfunctions are also a problem. In South Africa in 2007, a semi-autonomous cannon fatally shot 9 friendly soldiers. The ICRAC would like to see an international treaty, such as the one banning anti-personnel mines, that would outlaw some autonomous lethal machines. Such an agreement could still allow automated anti-missile systems. And there are also anti-small arms fire missiles, by the way, just so you know. These have elaborate radar systems that are set up in the perimeter, and then they have automatic machine guns and rocket launchers. If a single round comes in from another location, the trajectory can be reverse calculated, and the origin of that ordnance will immediately be targeted before the ordnance even strikes its target. Even at the speed of a bullet, the rounds can be going right back down the gun barrel from which they came within seconds. The question is whether systems are capable of discrimination, said Peter Asaro, a founder of the ICRAC and a professor at the New School in New York who teaches a course on digital war. The good technology is far off, but technology that doesn't work well is already out there. The worry is that these systems are going to be pushed out too soon, and they make a lot of mistakes, and those mistakes are going to be atrocities. Research into autonomy, some of it classified, is racing ahead at universities and research centers in the United States. Oh, and it's well-funded. And that effort is beginning to be replicated in other countries, also very well-funded. Lethal autonomy is inevitable, said Ronald C. Arkin, the author of Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots, a study that was funded by the Army Research Office. Arkin believes it is possible to build ethical military drones and robots capable of using deadly force while programmed to adhere to an international humanitarian law and rules of engagement. A likely story. He said software can be created that would lead machines to return fire with proportionality. You fire 5 rounds at us, we fire 5 rounds back to you. Minimize collateral damage, recognize surrender, and in the case of uncertainty, maneuver to reassess or wait for a human assessment. In other words, rules as understood by humans can be converted into algorithms, followed by machines for all kinds of actions on the battlefield, and every single one of these algorithms can easily be hacked by human activity. I requote, how a war-fighting unit may think. We are trying to make our systems behave like that, said Laura G. Weiss, chief scientist at the Georgia Tech Research Institute. Others, however, remain skeptical that humans can be taken out of the loop. Quote, autonomy is really the Achilles heel of robotics, said Johann Borenstein, head of the Mobile Robotics Lab at the University of Michigan. There's a lot of work being done, and still we haven't got to a point where the smallest amount of autonomy is being used in the military field. Utter and complete nonsense. All robots in the military are remote controlled. How does that sit with the fact that autonomy has been worked on at universities and companies for well over 20 years? Borenstein said human skills will remain critical in battle far into the future. The foremost of all skills is common sense, he said. Robots don't have common sense and won't have common sense in the next 50 years, or however long one might want to guess. Interesting and frightening at the same time. In about 15 minutes, we have L.A. Marzulli coming on the program. We have We're going to review two of his films, Watchers and Watchers 2. If you haven't had a chance to get these films, you can go to L.A. Marzulli's website, and you can take a look at it. Just do an Amazon search for Watchers or Watchers 2 with L.A. Marzulli. Pick up those films. Or I'm sure you can buy them at his website, and I'll post that here shortly. Interesting stuff. I can tell you that L.A. is one of those rare religious individuals that manages to come to terms with the fact that we are not alone on this planet, and I think the terms are reasonable, and I think you're going to enjoy his presence on the program. You know, the China is about to launch its first space station with the launch of the Tiangong 1, or Heavenly Palace, in a further sign of its race to catch up with the U.S. and Russia, as the International Space Station is slowly decaying to Earth for the last time. You know, we occasionally push it further out into space, resetting its orbit. As it heads for decay and eventual coming apart in the atmosphere, the Chinese are placing their own expandable space station into space. State media on Tuesday of this week reported that China would next week launch an unmanned craft from the Chinese western Gobi Desert that will be used for practicing operations at a future space station. The launch comes as the U.S. is cutting funding for its space program, having retired its space shuttle fleet after a last flight of the Atlantis in July. I want to put this in parentheses right here, that the space shuttles have not been dismantled. The entire fleet is still operational. It's just that they're not having space operations with them. Decisions to take the shuttles apart and to deactivate them have not been made yet. So it may be the next president that has to deal with using or not using the space shuttles. I think there's enough space junk and work in space for a salvage operation to more than pay for operating a space shuttle fleet for another 10 or 15 years. Although space experts warn of huge technological challenges ahead for the country's space station plans, the program would eventually make China, I want to reiterate this, I want to make sure you understand this, because the International Space Station is just that. It's an international space station. I repeat, the program would eventually make China the world's only nation with a space station. Just let that sink in for a moment. The China Manned Space Engineering Office has said it plans to complete the space station in 2020, just as the International Space Station is scheduled to retire, or to put it another way, to break apart in the atmosphere in a fiery display of finality. Spaceflight is the concrete reflection of the overall strength of a great power, said Jiao Weizhen, a professor at the School of Earth and Space Sciences at Peking University. While China's foreign policy doctrine tries to avoid trumpeting the country's rise, many citizens feel such technological prestige projects are part of a renaissance that will return the nation to its rightful place of a global power. In July, China joined a club of the select few nations' deep-sea submersibles capable of diving deeper than 5,000 meters. Last October, it ousted the U.S. as the maker of the world's fastest supercomputer. These achievements all contrast sharply with Beijing's huge challenges in modernizing a still poor and technologically weak country. The crash of two high-speed trains in July, which killed 40 people, triggered soul-searching among many middle-class Chinese questioning their government's relentless race for faster development. Kind of reminds us of us in the 1960s. The 9-meter-long space capsule has become another symbol of how China, backed by the wealth accumulated in its 3-decade economic boom, a state-led research push and a patriotic nation, is starting to close the gap on technologies once exclusive to the Cold War rivals, obviously fed by huge military budgets. If Chang'e 1 can successfully arrive and stay in space, China plans to practice docking at it. Later this year, a first unmanned docking mission is scheduled, followed by two manned docking exercises next year. Pretty aggressive. Later, Chang'e versions will then go on longer missions to prepare the launch of the space station in parts. Yes, it's coming together, and you're learning about it right here on X Squared Radio. We are covering the news as carefully and concisely as we can, because it's important that you understand the forces that are at work out there. Really quick, L.A. Marzulli is going to be coming on in about 9 minutes. Our call-in number is 888-429-5471. And also, if you want to reach us outside the United States, we do have callers in Australia, Japan, Europe. You can reach us by calling 530-413-4511. And if you want to listen on the conference line, you can call in with your cell phone, walk around with that smug look on your face with your Bluetooth, 760-569-7676. And then dialing the access code 192-919. One of my Skypers is writing and asking about CERN. And as luck would have it, I do have a piece on CERN. The speed of light results under scrutiny at CERN. How about this? Enormous underground detectors are needed to catch neutrinos that are so elusive as to be dubbed ghost particles. A meeting at CERN, the world's largest physics lab, has addressed results that suggest subatomic particles have gone faster than the speed of light. Wow. The team presented its work so other scientists can determine if the approach contains any mistakes. If the findings are proven to be accurate, they would overturn one of the pillars of the standard model of physics, which explains the way the universe and everything within it works. Einstein's theory of special relativity, proposed in 1905, states that nothing in the universe can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. But researchers at the CERN lab near Geneva claim they have recorded neutrinos, a type of tiny particle traveling faster than the barrier of 186,282 miles per second. He says, we don't allow neutrinos in here, says the bartender. A neutrino walks into a bar joke. That's interesting. The speed of light is widely held to be the universe's ultimate speed limit, and much of modern physics has laid out depends on that idea of nothing exceeding it. Well, there was a guy who did walk into a bar, actually, and it had a robot bartender. And the robot bartender asked in his robot voice, "What would you like?" And he said, "Well, I think I'll have a martini." And so the robot made him a great martini, one of the best he's ever had. And after he took his first sip and was about to munch on his first olive, the robot said, "What's your IQ?" And he said, 160. And the robot proceeded to talk about astrophysics and neuroscience. And the guy was greatly amused. This is really cool. A smart robot. So he comes back another day to the bar, walks in. Sure enough, the robot bartender still has a job. "What would you like?" "I'll take a martini." Again, a world-class martini. Again, the robot, "What's your IQ?" This time he says, 100. And the robot begins to talk about John Deere tractors and baseball and who's playing football this weekend. And he was really impressed. Here is a robot that can react to his customer. So the next time he came in, he decided to play a little bit with a robot. Again, he ordered a martini. Again, it was world class. First sip, and the robot said, "What's your IQ?" And he said, 50. And the robot said, leaning in very close, "So, you people still happy you voted for Obama?" Yeah, I hear it out there. I hear it. I hear the laughter. That's good. That's good. That's the reaction I wanted. In about 5 minutes, we have L.A. Marzulli coming on. Lots of experiments being done out there at CERN trying to understand why these particles can travel faster than the speed of light. Doesn't make a lot of sense, because if that happens, then it's really changed the standard model on its ear. We now have to rethink the speed limit of the universe. Maybe dark matter, dark energy out there isn't dark at all. Maybe it's super bright. The CERN team prepares a beam of just one type, muon neutrinos, and sends them through the Earth to an underground laboratory at Gran Sasso in Italy to see how many show up as a different type, tau neutrinos. In the course of doing the experiments, the researchers noticed that the particles showed up 60 billionths of a second earlier than they would have done if they traveled at the speed of light. This is a tiny fractional change, just 20 parts in a million, but it occurs consistently. It's repeatable. The team measured the travel times of neutrino bunches some 16,000 times and have reached a level of statistical significance that in scientific circles would count as a formal discovery. But the group understands that what are known as systematic errors could easily make an erroneous result look like a breaking of the ultimate speed limit. That has motivated them to publish their results. Dr. Erediato says, "My dream would be that another independent experiment finds the same thing. Then I would be relieved. But for now," he explains, "we are not claiming things. We want just to be helped by the community in understanding our crazy result, because it is crazy." By the way, interesting stuff on the UARS, the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite. It re-entered Earth's atmosphere overnight, most likely within 20 minutes of 12:16 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Nick Johnson, chief orbital debris scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, told reporters during a news brief today, at that time it would have fallen into the Pacific Ocean, well off the coast of North America. Interesting thing, though, there are an abundance of incredible reports and videos. Many people around the world have already exchanged that show the death plunge of this satellite. Almost all of these people, however, were in parts of the world significantly removed from where the satellite was passing over at the time. Now, one such video is out there and was shot yesterday in Italy. It shows a daytime plunge of two large pieces in the Mediterranean Sea. NASA claims the satellite was nowhere near Italy at the time. I would play you the video, but it's a home video, and it's in Italian, so not a whole lot I can do about that. But it is quite shocking to watch it, because this is obviously just a woman that's talking into the video camera, and they hear sirens off in the distance, and she looks to her left, the camera pans to the right, and you can clearly see these things coming down. It's really spectacular. All right, so we're going to try and get L.A. Marzulli to come on. I think we're trying to reach him.
I am here.
Aha, there he is. Welcome to the program, my friend. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
L.A. sent me a couple of his latest films, Watchers and Watchers 2. I got to tell you that the production quality of these is so good. Whoever you worked with as a team, I mean, just the interview quality, the picture quality, sound quality, and the scripting of it is just really tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all Richard Shaw, my partner. I mean, he's amazing at what he does, and it's a great team.
Well, you've been like all over the world lately. You've done a tremendous amount of work, a lot of research, a lot of stuff coming out of LA's Marzulli in the last year. And I'm fascinated by it because it's one of those things that takes a lot of dedication to get out there, to get off the beaten tourist path and get some real answers. There's no doubt that UFOs are here and they're not going away. But even science fiction communities are having a hard time figuring out what does this mean. So what does L.A. Marzulli say about what does it mean that all these UFOs are here?
Well, in my opinion, something is going on. I call it the coming great deception. And it takes a minute to explain this, but I believe my new book, which is just actually I'll get them tomorrow, so they're shipping this week. It's called The Cosmic Chess Match. And the hypothesis behind this is what if, and it's a big what if, there are two warring factions in another dimension? It sounds like a sci-fi movie, right? Two warring factions in another dimension that have been battling each other literally for millennia. And we see evidence of this cosmic war all throughout history. They're unequally yoked, and yet the battle rages. I think it's coming to an end. But here's that in mind. If you were going to take and create some sort of a great deception, and in other words, change billions of people's paradigms, in order to do that, you first have to eradicate their existing paradigm. And with all due respect to the Darwinists out there, who, because that's where I'm headed, will start yelling and screaming at me. That's okay. Just listen for a second. But what Darwinism does is it takes any type of a deity or any type of a supernatural element out of the equation and says, well, all this just happened randomly over billions of years. There is no supernatural. There's just what we see, just the empirical. When Ben Stein in his movie, which I find just incredible, his movie Expelled, when he sits down with Richard Dawkins, he just poses a simple question. Richard, where did life begin? And, Dawkins is honest and says, well, no one knows. No one knows where life began, and he's right about that. And Stein presses in, and he says, well, Dawkins finally answers, well, maybe millions of years ago in another galaxy, a race of aliens. And Stein's eyebrow goes up. And my whole point is, without realizing it, that's what Dawkins is. That's his answer. And maybe millions of years ago, in another galaxy, a race of extraterrestrials created life on this planet. I call that the coming great deception, or the alien gospel, which is basically that E.T. created all life on this planet, genetically manipulated early man, started the world's civilization, started the world's religions, and now at this critical juncture in human evolution, human history, they are back. And they will come back with probably some sort of free energy, which will completely turn us upside down and gain their trust, and probably some implantable chip. According to the research, this is brand new, from Dr. Roger Lear, who's taken and removed 16 of these implants from people. So he's not blowing smoke. I've held these things in my hand. It's nanotechnology. They're receiving radio waves from deep space someplace, and they're powered by the person's circulatory/nervous system. I mean, we're not in Kansas anymore. And so something is going on. It's a question, what paradigm best addresses the phenomena? Is it extraterrestrial or interdimensional? I believe it's interdimensional.
Well, I mean, that brings up a really good question because, it doesn't take much of a jump from considering UFOs to considering that, either they're drones or they're manned by some being. Well, let's say they are manned. Let's say they are possess some intelligent live thing inside. Mm-hmm. Where could they possibly come from? I mean, no law of physics allows them to travel for light years by riding some sort of ion drive or a solar wind. So how do they travel these distances to Earth? You're saying interdimensional. What's an interdimensional being?
Well, if we go back into, quantum physics, which I really don't understand, I don't pretend to understand, but the modern physicists believe that there are other dimensions other than the ones that we see. And what if there are other dimensions which actually coexist with ours, let's say, that are always around us, but we just don't see them. And then these entities use craft to flit between the dimensions. I'll give you one example from ancient prophetic texts. There's a guy, and he's actually in what's now current Iraq. Okay, near Babylon. And he sends out a request, mentally. He sends out a request. And 21 days later, a luminous being shows up. and says, hey, I'm paraphrasing all this, okay? Basically, he says, Daniel, I would have been here sooner, but I got held up by the Prince of Persia for 21 days. And, you know, you read that and you go, wait a minute, 21 days? I mean, what's the deal here? And then the luminous being goes, well, I had to go back and get reinforcements, and this, you know, we kind of fought our way through. He doesn't say fought our way through, but basically that's what it implies. There's some sort of battle going on, and then he shows up. Hi, I'm here. He just kind of pops in. Well, it seems like, and I'm drawing conclusions here that maybe some other researchers won't agree with, but it seems like there are gateways or portals between this one dimension and our dimension. And we have ancient prophetic texts which, you know, give us very interesting stories that seem to indicate that that's what we're looking at. It's alarming.
Well, it is. I mean, the fact that we do have these records in ancient scripture, we also see them carved on walls and recorded in codexes and, you know, carved into golden plates. We even have religions founded upon interaction with these interdimensional beings that can kind of just appear in the bedroom, you know, make a speech and then leave. So, you know, we certainly have lots of evidence from perfectly sane people that kinds of things happen. But, you know, the question comes to us, why would they be here? I mean, what's so special about Earth? What's so special about humans? And, you know, just speaking on behalf of quantum physicists, I'm just a theoretical physicist, so I don't really know. But I have investigated, you know, reading the theory of 26 different dimensions, and I suppose it's just as ludicrous for us to say it's impossible for someone to live in a rotational dimension of string theory as it is for those who do exist there saying, third dimension? Come on, who would exist in a third dimension? So it probably is true, but for a being to come from a dimension which has completely different laws of physics, a different approach to existence than we have here, to this dimension and be a presence here. So why would they be here? What is so special about this little tiny water planet on the outer rim of the Milky Way? And what's so special about humans?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, philosophers have pored over that or different aspects of that question for millennia. And if we're intellectually honest, we really don't know where we are, how we got here, or where we're going. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, like you said, we're floating on this little blue sphere in the middle of at the edge of the Milky Way, and who knows where that really is in terms of the entire universe. We don't understand consciousness. I mean, when we, let's say the 18th, 19th century, whatever, and people quested that and began to dissect the brain, and they realized that there's no observation deck there. There's no, you know, platform where consciousness sits. How does consciousness integrate with this body that we're in? I mean, that in itself is a mystery, and it gets into all sorts of metaphysical stuff, and, you know, people have tried to figure that out, and there's all these different religions basically attempting to deal with some of that. Is there a hereafter?
There's scientific communities wrestling with it too. I mean, a lot of
exactly
have Amit Goswami and even Michio Kaku and others are coming to the realization that consciousness is involved in the process of moving from energy to matter and from matter back to energy. We're not sure how,
right?
But we know that consciousness has an effect on their path, on the creation, on the behavior of that creation, because it's duplicatable and it's clinical. So if we have that effect by accident or even by design, how far can we take that effect? How much does our observation of this universe really count toward its behavior?
And of course, again, that's a very, very deep question, and it's probably a three-hour discussion, and at the end of the 3 hours, we'd probably be no further in solving that mystery. We just don't know those things. We know that that sometimes, I'll just give an example, a mother sees her son, two-year-old boy, pinned under a car, and she lifts the car up. How does that work? you know, physically all bets are off. She can't do that, and yet she does that. And we've heard stories like that, you know, that have come down. Some of them are very colorful, but some of them also are real. I mean, they're really true. They're true stories. I'll just tip my hand early here. I'm a blatant supernaturalist. I believe that we are surrounded by supernatural beings in other dimensions. I believe in the prophetic, in other words, that someone, some entity, call him what you wish, it what you wish. I have my, you know, terminology for what I believe he is. And to me, it's a he. But that's, again, debatable in some people's paradigm. But if there's someone that outside our space-time continuum that somehow sees all of time at the same time, in other words, they don't go from point to point to point. They see it simultaneously, and they can interface with all points of time simultaneously. So they're, for them, I mean, it's like, it's interesting. We sit here and we're talking, and it's like, where is the now? Well, the now just happened, right? We can't pinpoint it. Yeah, you're hearing my words, but I'm still moving into the future. So even though I just said that sentence, that's in the past, and now I'm speaking again, and we're still, where is now? You know, that it's constantly moving into the future. And the past is just a few seconds ago, but it's the past. I can no longer reclaim that. But if we have a being, let's say, who's outside our space-time continuum and somehow can access all points of time, and then let's say, for instance, hypothetically, this being is benevolent, he's good, he would be then be giving us prophecy, telling us what would happen to our planet, to mankind, at the end of time. And that's what I hold very dear to, because I've seen these prophetic utterances happen in real time, over and over and over and over again. So that's kind of where I place my chips.
Let me add my thoughts on this, because prophecies, by definition, are conditional predictions. This is what's going to happen if you continue to do this, or this is what's going to happen if you don't do this. So the universe being considered all at one time is not so outlandish, especially from a physics standpoint, because we just need to consider the existence of a photon. A photon leaving Arcturus doesn't take 8+ light years to get here. It does from our perspective. From its perspective, it's here instantaneously. There's no path between Arcturus and Earth, which means at the speed of light, all time comes to a standstill.
Uh-huh, right.
It means all past, yes, all possible futures are now. Now, does that mean that human consciousness can consider the universe at the speed of light? It probably has, but I think that humans, because of this creation, choose to observe this universe at the speed that it is now, so it can stretch out and be observable in this third dimension. And that's why it appears to be, you know, millions and billions of light years across. It really isn't. It's still the singularity. It never did burst. It never did come apart. It's only our observation as a collective, as beings of this being you're talking about, that make it so. And so, again, I have to ask my question, what's so special about humans, and why would these supernatural beings be here? I mean, if we were so special, why have they not interacted with us more? Why leave us in the dark and hunting for answers? Why don't they come out and disclose who they are and why they're here? I mean, well, the government isn't going to disclose anything truthful.
No, of course not. Of course not. I think they have. I think they have, over the millennia, told us exactly who they are, what they are, and certain protocols in which they operate under. It's whether or not we choose to believe what we're being told. They've also left signs, artifacts along the way, I'm not talking, you know, stone temples like in Baalbek and Lebanon, which is certainly an artifact. Let's say that this war spilled out onto this planet at some point in the not too far distant past. Let's just round it off to about 10,000 years ago. And let's say these luminous beings touched down on Mount Hermon. Of course, there's an ancient prophetic text called the Book of Enoch. It was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, very, very old, and very, very interesting. It's, in fact, it was not translated into English until the latter part of the 19th century. and it was almost lost to Western eyes, and yet it's quoted in the Christian Bible in several places. So this thing's been around for a while. Anyway, oh, yeah. Found it.
Jesus quoted it 128 times in the New Testament.
Well, so you know which I refer to. The Book of Enoch's been you know, yeah, I agree. It's quoted all over the place. But it talks about these angelic beings, 200 of them coming to Earth and doing the unthinkable, at least from, you know, certain perspectives, having sex with the women and creating some sort of a hybrid. And it begs the question, well, why would they do this? You know, what's the point? Is it like a weekend fling, like a bunch of frat boys, you know, having some fun on the weekend? Well, what we see is they're here for about 400 years. David Flynn, who, by the way, is struggling with a brain tumor right now, and I don't know, I haven't heard the latest, but I owe this to David. This is his work, his research. He postulated using the old 360-day calendar and nautical terms and latitudinal terms from antiquity. If you were to go from Mount Hermon, which is where the Book of Enoch tells us these angelic beings landed, which, of course, is in between Lebanon, Syria, and Israel today, sort of a no-man's land today. But if you were to go to the polar opposite in the same latitudinal line, you would wind up in Roswell, New Mexico. Now, is that just coincidence that, you know, we have one incursion that the Book of Enoch tells us thousands and thousands of years ago, and then we've got this incident that happens 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico, which, of course, the government has changed its stories three or four times now. You know, everything from weather balloons to it's just Project Mogul and on it goes. I think something happened, but I just find that interesting, and that's the work of Dave Flynn. He put that together. It's a very interesting paper that he wrote a number of years ago, which really stood, the entire UFO community really took notice of that because, wow, you know, that's just something else going on here. That's just not coincidence. So my point is this, that again, I get into this in the Cosmic Chess Match, this new book, but I believe that this war between angelic beings who are in a fallen state, and that's the crew that basically came down here thousands of years ago, landed on Mount Hermon, had sex with the women. The offspring is this character called the Nephilim. I've written books about this. And these guys could have been, and Steve Quayle gets into this, he's got a wonderful chart in one of his books on giants. These things, Quayle postulates 35 feet. Okay, let's say that that's way out of line. Let's bring it back down. Let's say it's only 20 feet. When I'm out speaking on the road, I show pictures of Baalbek, and I show some of the stones and how absolutely humongous these things are. One of them is kind of still stuck in the ground. It hasn't been broken off from the bed of the quarry. Well, the thing's almost 70 feet in length, 16 feet by 13 feet, and the sides are perfect. I mean, they're not rough. Roughly hewn. It begs the question, you know, why did a bunch of people get up on a Monday morning and go, hey, we're going to build some temples and we need these big rocks and we're not sure how we're going to move them, but it's like, what? But then if you factor 20-foot tall beings that are basically, use the word here, demonically enhanced, they're superhumans, strength-wise. All of a sudden, it's like Occam's razor. Which answer is, you know, the simplest answer is usually the correct one. Well, the locals today in Baalbek still say that the giants built these structures in Baalbek, these temples. What if? What if we had 20-foot Nephilim running around on this planet? And we hear other stories, even from the Native Americans in this country, talking about a race of giants, red-haired race of giants. It's bizarre. I mean, it's just bizarre. So there's a lot of stuff we're not being told.
You have the Romans who, you know, put together their weapon systems and went about conquering the world, or at least their known world, and they came up against forces. Even their phalanxes, even their best engines of war, could not conquer them. So they had to build special weapons called ballistas. Mm-hmm. And these were like mobile crossbows on steroids.
And I'm familiar with them, yes.
They'd shoot an 8 to 12 pound bolt with a tip on it, and it was designed to punch through the armor of giants. And what they would do is they would draw these giants down into the battle, sacrificing thousands, because these guys could just whack a man in two with one blow. And they would just unload these bolts on them and fire through their breastplates. There was a record found in the Yucatan that described a breastplate that was 1 meter wide to the armpits.
Mm.
1 meter. That's over a yard between armpits.
That's big.
That's a big guy.
It's a big guy. There's an amateur archaeologist, and I've had him on my show, Acceleration Radio, several times. And he talks about, you mentioned the Yucatan. That's what triggered that. In South America, I think it's in Central America is where the site is. I'm not exactly positive. But there's a site that he knows of, and he swears there are gigantic bones there. The bones of the giants are there. And he's, you know, trying to raise money to go in and dig these things up. And we've heard, look, I get a lot of very bizarre emails. I had a very cryptic email, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, from an intermediary who is acting as a go-between between myself and this other person. Don't know whether the other person was male or female. I have no clue. They really kept their identity, you know, under the radar. And very colorful story. And it makes great radio, by the way. There's no way I can vet this. But the story was this, that several years, so maybe let's say 7 or 8 years ago, this person was working in the Four Corners region. That's basically all they would tell me. And there was a flash flood. And this flash flood uncovered an ancient burial site on a reservation. And these people were called in, made to sign national security statements not to reveal what they saw. And the Smithsonian were there, apparently. And there was this flash flood that uncovered this ancient burial ground. And in that burial ground were giants with red hair, 6 digits, and these things were between 9 and 12 feet tall. The Smithsonian came in, crated them up. They signed, you know, non-disclosure forms, blah, blah, blah. Stuff was carted off. The site returned to somewhat normal, and that's the end of it. You know, I can't vet that, but it's an amazing story. Do I believe it? There are tales, I think, of the Pawnee tribe that talks about, again, red-haired giants that could pick up the very colorful story, could pick up a bison, full-grown bison under one arm. So we're looking at a guy who's about 20 feet tall. I mean, basically the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, I can hold 1,200 pounds like we hold a six-pack.
There you go. And that's crazy. So, you know, we keep hearing more and more of this. Is it all legend? Is there some truth behind it? Very difficult to vet this stuff. But we know that the bones of the giants were found as the United States, as settlers pushed west. We know for a fact that that's what we saw. So getting back to my original premise, you know, there seems to be something going on. And you say, well, how does that relate to the modern UFO phenomena? Well, it does, in my opinion, very much so. Because in the same way that these Nephilim were hybrids thousands and thousands of years ago, and perhaps in more recent times, what we see is with the abduction phenomena in ufology, we see the same type of genetic manipulation where they're very interested in reproduction. When men are taken, the sperm is taken, sperm samples. With the women, ovum is taken. Oftentimes, the woman finds herself pregnant. Implants are put into these people. And see, that sounds bizarre until, and this is what's so great about Dr. Roger Lear's research, and of course, we've interviewed him for Watchers 1, 2, and the one we're working on now, Watchers 3. But it's so great having Dr. Lear because he's removed 16 of these, and there's nanotechnology in them. And guess what? The metal is not found on this planet. The closest thing we have to it is meteorite metal. In other words, metal extracted from where a meteor has gone down. Let's say that big crater in Arizona. It's unbelievable. And they're there. And these people who have them removed talk about their abduction. And they don't, you know, what's interesting about this too is these people aren't into notoriety. They're not looking for money. They just want the things out of them. And they feel relieved when these things are taken out and they can see them. And it's like, you know, gee, I wasn't crazy. See? And they look at their spouse and go, see, I told you. And then of course, these things are sliced open. Dr. Lear told us recently for Watchers 3, that they took an implant out and they could not cut it open with a diamond-bladed saw. They took it to a laboratory and finally had a laser cut through it. So it just gives you an idea what we're up against here.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, why would they be here? What's so special about Earth? What's so special about humans? And this could be it, because when we talk about UFOs, you know, at first it starts out with lights in the sky, then it you know, goes to landings, and inevitably, in every community that I go to, every, you know, MUFON event that you know, I speak at or visit, it ends up at abductions. Somewhere yes. along the line, there is an involuntary, I should say involuntary, contact between these beings and humans, and it's not a picnic. It's not something that, and maybe that's why science fiction is depicting every single alien encounter, I know, in the last 5 years, has been some brain-eating, you know, genocidal, you know, super race that comes here. And if it's not bacteria that wipes them out, it's the ability of humans to breed like rabbits and hide like bacteria that eventually gets them and wins them over. Of course, you got to have some kind of happy ending in the movies, but the fact that they come here and they have these abilities just raises my curiosity that, you know, LA, you and I realize that we're not this, you know, bag of water and protein. Right. We are this animated, live, eternal, spiritual being having a mortal experience. So whatever they do to the physical body is of no consequence to the soul. It comes back. It lives on. It is eternal. And there's nothing they can do to it. Maybe that's what fascinates them about us.
I would venture that on some level, other than the breeding program, which is going on, they're very interested in, very, very interested. Dr. David Jacobs' books talks about how they've invested a lot of time into the breeding program and a lot of energy into their breeding program. The question is, you know, why are they making this hybrid? There's an ancient prophetic text that says, as in the days of Noah, so it will be at the return of the Son of Man. It's a very interesting prophecy. And it immediately begs the question, what differentiates the days of Noah from any other time in history? And we've already kind of touched on that with the idea of the fallen angels from the book of Enoch. When you look at the Genesis, the Christian Bible, the Genesis passage that talks about the flood and Noah and everything else, and you put it side by side with the book of Enoch, they're almost identical, with the exception. Yeah, with the exception that the book of Enoch sort of elaborates, it amplifies on the story. So there's no question what's going on here.
Well, you have two different perspectives. I mean, Noah's building the boat and trying to save all of mankind. Enoch has his own city, and he's Noah's grandson. Right. And, you know, he's negotiating with the giants in the book of Enoch, who are trying to survive. And Enoch's going to God, basically, and saying, okay, what about the giants? I mean, they really want to live. They want to survive. They want to know if they can make a deal. And God basically says, no deal. They're going to be wiped out.
Yeah, you shall have no peace, right?
Exactly. So, you know, that's the relationship. But Noah doesn't have that relationship. Noah is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years older than Enoch and doesn't live in the same area. And so they have different perspectives on the same story, which really adds life to it. And I'm so surprised that the early church threw it out. By the way, the original version, not the original one, but the one that survived the longest was in Slavonic. And so LA is exactly right. It was, I think, 1875 or 1860. I know Thomas Jefferson had a copy of it in his library, but it was in Slavonic. Ellie, we got to take a quick break just to let affiliates do what they're going to do. We don't run commercials here. We just talk right through everything. But let's take about a four-minute break. We'll be right back with more L.A. Marzulli. Don't go away. More X-Squared Radio coming your way. Sit back, relax, loosen your seatbelt. We'll be right back. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. As we begin the second hour, our guest tonight is L.A. Marzulli. This is Lisa Gerard and her album, The Unfolding. Peter Bork helping her with the music. Hope you enjoyed it. Those of you that listen live get to hear the whole thing. Those of you that are listening on archives, you get about the last minute and the intro to it. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed place east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, about 73 degrees. Much needed rain passing overhead. By the way, if you had any satellite material fall in your backyard over the last couple of days, you might want to scoop that up. There's a lot of gold and platinum in that. Good jobs out there in satellite or recovery. And if you're interested, you might want to make a Salvage 1 vehicle and get up there and start scooping up about 20,000 pieces of space junk that's up there. It could use recovering, and we could use clearing the highway, especially if the Chinese are planning on putting their new space station up there. There's a lot to clean up, and it's getting kind of crowded up there. We may have to go further and further out into orbit, or we may have to build that ring world that Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell talked about several years ago in their books. Our guest tonight, L.A. Marzulli, produced two films, The Watchers and The Watchers 2. I watched them, and I didn't even finish my bag of popcorn. They were so good. And The Watchers 3 is getting ready to come out. These are really, really landmark productions. If you want to see the Discovery Channel on steroids, no commercials, everything thrown at you with everything it got, you need to pick these films up. L.A., can you tell our listeners how to pick up these films?
Well, the best way right now is to go to – and thanks so much for your review there. It means a lot coming from you, and thank you for your kind words. Appreciate that. But the best place to get it is lamarzulli.net, www.lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net, and you can apprise yourself of Watchers 1 and Watchers 2.
All right, and of course they can get it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that if they want to go out there and buy it as well. But it's best to buy it from L.A.'s website because he can then send you emails letting you know when other great L.A. Marzulli studies are coming out. Now, do you have any expeditions, trips or journeys that you put on once or twice a year that people can join? Can they go travel with you and see these places and listen to you lecture live?
Well, there is I'm actually going on a cruise, and it's which will be fun in San Diego. I think it leaves October 8th to the 15th. It's on a cruise ship when we go down the western side of Mexico, hit Puerto Vallarta, Mazatlan, and some other places. We're not really looking at ruins. I'll be speaking, I think, every night in the evening, probably right after dinner, on the cruise ship. And I've got five, six different PowerPoint presentations. And I just came back from Atlanta last weekend, or the weekend before last, and spoke 9 hours on Saturday to a crowd of people. And, we took a lot of breaks and stuff, but we went 9 hours, and I think they got it complete with PowerPoint. So that's I am like you. I travel and speak and talk and try to alert people to what I think is about to come on the planet.
Excellent stuff. Well, that's what we do. I mean, I have my day job, you all know. Don't forget the Pythagoras Conference coming up in December. It's in Louisville, Kentucky. Can you believe it? A Midwestern conference. Wow. Like, it's not on the West Coast, East Coast, not in Atlanta or Florida. Mm-hmm. You can actually drive there, and guess what? It's at the Galt House. So if you have never been in the Galt House in Louisville, this is really going to be a wonderful conference. And it's way affordable. Sandra Sabatini's done a great job in organizing it and bringing the cost down so that more people can enjoy it. Times are hard now. We realize that. But 20 speakers in the Midwest And I don't think you want to miss that one. Let's start off this hour. We were talking about the Nephilim in the last hour, giants, and there's certainly no shortage of carvings and evidence and legends and stories. And in this hour, and by the way, if you want to stay for all 3 hours, we're wide open to do that. And I got the notice from the studio that the host that comes on after me is not going to show up tonight. So if we want to go a little bit long, if you want to call in and get involved in this, we highly recommend it. We are able to go long. The toll-free number anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. If you're not in the U.S. or if you're off-planet, then you can get to a cell phone just so you can get to us. 530-413-4511. And if you have to walk away, which we don't recommend walking away from this live program, but you can call in with your cell phone and listen with your Bluetooth. You can join our conference line at 760-569-7676. Dial the passcode 192-919. You won't be able to talk to us, but you'll be able to listen. And by the way, if you're on Skype, don't hesitate. Many of you do. Send me those Skype messaged questions because you're too afraid to come on the air and be heard globally. That's okay. That's okay. We'll treat you like a neighbor if you come on here at X Squared Radio. Remember, X Squared is a function. Every number put into it comes out positive. So nothing to fear here. In this hour, let's see if we can discuss. And we've had this on the program a couple of times. I'll be honest, I haven't really got a good explanation, but I got a feeling that's going to change tonight. What are orbs, and why are all these things happening now?
Well, the orb phenomena is really interesting. And first of all, we need to understand that a lot of the lights in the sky, for instance, in the Watchers, UFOs Are Real Bird Hitting Not Going Away DVD, we have a clip of this guy who calls himself Prophet Yahweh. And that's another three-hour discussion to just talk about where he is, what we're looking at, why he can do the things that he can do. He's got it on film. I mean, they had a film crew from Las Vegas that went out there. They thought that this guy was just, you know, they were ready to yuck it up. I mean, because the guy comes out and he just raises his hands and he does this whole deal. Well, lo and behold, something manifested. Something manifested, and it was a light.
Time, right? This is broad daylight, not nighttime where you see satellites.
This is broad daylight. It's not a plane. It's a light in the sky. We've also seen, and you know, it's all on film, and the guys are freaking out. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's plain as day. There it is. Not sure what's going on. There's a place called East City Ranch, which we talked to a person who went up there, and this individual saw all sorts of orbs come in. I mean, all sorts of orbs just come in. She also saw what she would call fairies, for lack of a better word. And I realize, you know, people listen to that and go, come on, you know, this is like way out. We've got pictures of this stuff and we show it on Watchers 1. They're about a little over a foot tall. And the wings, this person said, were so loud, they almost had to cover her ears. I mean, you know, you kind of pinch yourself. You can't believe what you're looking at. But the orbs are not craft, obviously. The orbs are not craft, yet they are under intelligent control. We saw, we weren't allowed to use this footage, but we saw extensive footage of taken, basically, up at East City. And in one shot, one sequence, there's an orb which hovers behind a person and then enters at the base of the neck. And does not come out. You can plainly see it. It enters at the base of a neck and doesn't come out. So from my worldview and my perspective and the paradigm I operate under, that's the last thing you want to have happen to you. You don't want a foreign object that you don't know, whether it's malevolent or benevolent, to enter into you under any circumstances. But see, here's the deal. These people who are there give the orbs permission beforehand. So they've already let their guard down, sort of. In other words, you know, they will literally say out loud sometimes, you know, we invite you, we give you permission to manifest, and then they manifest. And some, you know, it, look, there's a guy that has Andy on the Edge radio show, and By the way, he's suffering with, four-stage cancer and not doing so well, but great guy. And Andy came up with the sort of the saying, if someone knocks on your door at 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't let them in. You know, you sit there, who are you? What do you want? What's going on? And if you got a gun, maybe you'll hold the gun while you're talking to him through the door. You just don't know in today's world. Well, I mean, these people are out there, and yeah, this stuff looks benevolent, but there's no way. You know, why should we just open ourselves up to entities that we have no idea where they're from, what they want, what they're doing here, and whether they're malevolent or benevolent, or they have good intentions towards me or evil intentions towards me. We don't know that. So I find that very alarming that these people are doing it. I believe, to answer your question, finally, that these entities are disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. That's what I truly believe that they are. They're earthbound. And other prophetic texts talk about that these entities were at one time the Nephilim. And you remember, people say, well, you know, how long were the giants here? Again, it's not a frat little weekend excursion with a bunch of fraternity boys. You know, these guys were here. These luminous entities, call them, you know, angelos just means messenger. These other entities, luminous entities with superhuman power, certainly by our standards, were here for between 400 and 500 years. And I'm being conservative. Lots of mischief went on in that 400 or 500 years. So they sired perhaps tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these beings. And we're told that they all perished in the flood. So what happens to their souls? In my opinion, they are earthborn entities which travel all over this planet and have been locked into the upper atmosphere of the planet. But they manifest as orbs, and people see these things now all the time. Orbs are not craft. They're two totally different entities.
That's interesting. It's an interesting take. I know they've been around a long time, because when I traveled in Tibet, we were not in Lhasa. We were in one of the outlying communities. I mm-hmm. think it was Shigatse. And went into the temple, and it's a rather tight, not really open, big temple. It's a very small temple, and lots of pilgrims come there. And hanging from the ceiling of this temple, from fishing line, were Christmas ornaments, you know, like the glass balls that you hang on your tree, blue ones and red ones and gold ones. And I'm in there with our guide from Tibet, who speaks English very well. And I'm filming. I had to pay a little bit to be able to do that. And there weren't any Chinese around, so I was able to get some good film. And I noticed these, and I asked my guide, go ask the monk that's running the place, what are those things hanging from the ceiling? And he came back and he said, I think he explained that they're planets. And so I looked up and I said, no, that doesn't make any sense. They're not in orbit around anything. There's no sun. They're not in a plane. They're different sizes, different colors. Go back and ask him again and come back with a more clear explanation. So he asked him again, and he came back and said, the best explanation I can give you in English is they're balls of light. I said, oh, they're orbs. They're orbs. And so I explained to him what orbs were. He went back, and I saw the monk nodding, and then the conversation, and he came back, and he said, yes, they're there for the pilgrims who come here, because he said the pilgrims are dimensionally blind, and they can't see the orbs. So we hang them from the ceiling so that they know they're here when they come here. And they're kind of seen as a symbol of the presence of divinity. They really feel good and peaceful when these lights are around. And I got to tell you, I've been to East City for 5 years, up there every summer for a week to speak. And I have, you know, put on the infrared goggles and seen oceans of these things going overhead. There's a lot more than 400. There might be 400 million. But it is a tremendously euphoric, peaceful, full of love feeling. I got to tell you.
Well, and that's – let me play devil's advocate here if I can. I had a period of time where I was in an ashram. My third eye was open, and I experienced all sorts of supernatural meditations and all that. Again, there's got to be a litmus test. Just because we feel euphoric, in other words, I can't trust my feelings. Jacques Vallée calls some of these entities messengers of deception. We hear oftentimes from people who actually have encounters with these beings. Now, you're standing in a field, you're watching this stuff, you know, come through, fine, and you can feel euphoric. Let me switch gears here to give you another paradigm, another view. 1917, Portugal, Fatima, Portugal. 75,000 people were standing in a field because they believe that the Blessed Virgin Mary is manifesting there to these three children. There's a cross-section of humanity. Everybody's there, bankers, photographers, the clergy, the mayor, the politicians, farmers, old, the young, everybody, the infirm. It's been raining all day. The apparition said it would show up at 12 noon. Well, the apparition's late. At 1 o'clock, the children say, that she's here, she's here. It's been raining all day. The sky suddenly parts, and the people see this phenomenon. Look, 70,000 people experienced it. There's no doubt about that. You know, I mean, even to the skeptic, it's like they know something happened. They're just not sure what it is. And people have different explanations of what they saw. But when you go back into the original interviews, people say, I look up and saw a silver disc. I looked up and saw a dull silver disc. The word disc is used many times, and the word silver disc, the expression silver disc is used. Remember, it's 1917. The words, the terminology UFOs, flying saucers are not part of a lexicon that would come later in the century. So people are looking at these things and calling them for what they are. Now, there was feelings of euphoria and fear. Euphoria because they were all witnessing a miracle, but then some sort of a miracle, something supernatural. But then this thing began to wobble and descend to the earth. And at that point, pandemonium broke out. Some people thought it was the end of the world. And then it just kind of sat there for a while and then slowly went back up and released this sort of yellow substance, which like string-like, which evaporated after a while, after it was on the ground for a bit. But that got turned into rose petals. So, by the way, the people's clothes were dry, suddenly dry. Everybody's out in the rain with umbrellas, but, you know, they're damp and wet. And after this thing was finished, people's clothes were dry, reported of healings and all this other stuff. Well, again, I look at that and I call that event a harbinger of deception. Here's the reason why, Brooks, with all due respect to everyone who, you know, might disagree. We're having a conversation, so we each have different paradigms, and that's fine. You know, we cling to the paradigms that we believe in. But unless we can test, if there's a way to test these entities, we don't know what it is we're dealing with. And we can't go by our feelings, in my opinion. Just can't. Because in the same way that I believe these people at Fatima were totally duped, I call that harbinger of deception. It wasn't the sun falling, and it certainly wasn't the Mary of the Bible, something else. And the same thing I think happening in East Teddy Ranch. Unless there's a way to test the spirits, and there actually is a way to test these things, but I won't get into that on the show, but there is a way to test the spirits. I've done and been involved in some exorcisms, and when these people, similar to what happened at Fatima, similar in some cases what can happen, I'm not saying it's happened at East Teddy, but it can happen, it can go there, they let these things in and they become possessed, and they want their lives back, and at that point it can get real nasty. There is a person, her name is Sharon Beekman. She was involved in channeling for a period of time. And, you know, she was having fun, and she had spirit guides and the whole deal, and it was really cool. And then she decided, well, I'm done now. I want to move on. I'm tired of the spirit guides. And guess what? They wouldn't leave. And her book is fascinating because, she has no axe to grind in this thing. But either way, she didn't know what she was getting into. And when they turned on her, it was, for her, it was basically hell on earth for 3 years. Now, I'm not saying all, you know, everything is like that. But when you read Sharon Beekman's account, it's the classic spiritual take of spirit guides and all this. But when she asked them to leave, they wouldn't leave. And they tormented her basically for 3 years. She finally got out of it. She finally turned and got the victory. Another example is a man I interviewed, Lawrence Gray, 1966-67. There's this entity in West Virginia called the Mothman, which, of course, is a misnomer. But this thing was a winged creature, depending on who you talk to, between 7 and 9 feet tall, dark wings, black wings. The head was sunk down into the shoulder. The eyes were absolutely hypnotic. This thing appeared in this guy's room at 2 in the morning, 2:30 in the morning. He awakens from a dead sleep, looks out the window. There's a car that goes by and turns his head, and the thing's standing there at the foot of his bed. Well, obviously that's an incredibly nightmarish situation. And, you know, Gray's looking at this thing, and he's absolutely paralyzed. He can't even speak. He's just paralyzed. Well, in the interview that I did with him, we had to stop several times because as he's talking about this, all that fear that was there in that encounter, I asked him, what was it like? Describe what this entity was like. He had one word for it, Brooks, and it was wickedness. Wickedness. Wow. That was manifested. So, again, he got victory over it. He drove the thing out of his room. He knew what to do. He was one of the few people that saw the Mothman. In fact, the only person I've spoken to in the research that I've done with Mothman that was able to repel it and remove it from his presence. Everybody else succumbed to it. Everybody else, there's a saying from one of the Mothman researchers, no one who ever saw this thing ever walked away feeling good. And you know, this is an interview I did in 2000, I think, in 9, I think it was. The Alien Interviews book, which we sell on my website, but with Lawrence Gray. So it is now decades after 1966, 67, and this man has to stop 2 or 3 times and, yeah, you know, collect himself because it was so traumatic.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. So I mean, we can take this to the next level and say that these influences are there. They are out there, whether they occur here or there or, you know, on this side of the planet or the other, or at night or during the day, these influences can be felt. And the instruction, you could call it channeling, does take place. And it might answer the question why our races are always at war. Why are the nations of the world always in turmoil? I mean, we've been at war for 1,000 years. And over what? You know, we spent $1.3 trillion this year on national defense. Against who, L.A.? I know we haven't faced a uniformed soldier in 10 years. I doubt we will in this decade. Who are we preparing to fight? What's going on in our world?
Well, that's a very complex question. But what we see, and you're obviously correct about this, is man has a great proclivity to slay one another. And all we need to do is look at the thin veneer of civility that's in this country when we look at Katrina. And 48 hours later, there's looting and murders and rape and every other foul and nasty little thing. It seems to be that when all hell breaks loose, or when people can take what they want to take. I mean, another example of that is Saddam Hussein marching into Kuwait. And then, it's one thing to take the country. It's another thing to absolutely humiliate and do some of the heinous behavior. I mean, just absolutely insane behavior that they did when they marched into Kuwait. But it's interesting. The Turkish President Erdogan was blabbing on and on about how Israel is this and Israel is that. Well, you know, my blog probably tomorrow will be about this. It's like he's not too keen on mentioning the 1.2 million Armenian Christians that were forced marched to their death in World War I. We don't want to talk about that now, do we?
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I sat down with the ambassador from Turkey a week ago today.
Well,
he's a great guy, and his whole staff, awesome people. They all want to work. They all want peace. They're intelligent, you know, commercial people, and they want, you know, to do what they want to do. But then again, I meet with the ambassador, not the president. But, you know, the point is that there, people that have a proclivity to do that already have that proclivity and are held at bay from doing that by police. And when something like Katrina comes in that breaks down the alarm
systems,
that more or less keeps honest people honest. Then the people that are not honest, you know, come out of their shell. They come out of the woodwork. But I got to tell you, I was down in New Orleans just a couple of weeks ago, and it's not the same New Orleans it was back in 2004. Mm. All that riffraff, they're gone. There's no place for them to live. It's a nice, decent place. And you don't feel like you're going to be panhandled to death by the time you get to the box down there.
Well, let me move on to something else as far as the this proclivity for endless war. And, you know, it's funny. It's like and we can open up all sorts of interesting windows. We can get into the whole thing of, in my opinion, you know, the Kennedy assassination. He was our last president. He was trying to get us off the Federal Reserve, which has nothing to do with our government, as I know you know, trying to abolish the CIA, split it into 1,000 pieces. 2 weeks before he was assassinated, he talked about secret societies. What is he pointing to in this country and how we abhor that type of thing in America? He was, I believe, a constitutionalist, and he was going to bring our boys back from Vietnam. I mean, and they blew him away in Dallas. It was a public execution. And in my opinion, we have not had a real president since then. It's interesting to watch the endless war.
It's interesting to watch the debates. And
the debates are a joke, except for Ron Paul, in my opinion.
Yeah, Ron Paul. It's funny, you know, he gets on there. He wins the California straw poll.
Right.
And then they give him 3 30-second questions out of the whole group. The rest of it all go to people who have less percentage than he does.
Yes, it is completely manipulated. It is a sham. It is an absolute sham and a travesty to think that this is the electoral process in this country. I know the Iowa poll, I think he came in second on that. Bachman came in first, but only by a point. A point away was Ron Paul. You didn't hear anything about Ron Paul. All you heard about were the three candidates, you know, Perry and Romney and Bachman. But Paul came in second. And, I mean, Americans need to understand that as Chuck Missler calls it, it is a managed agenda that we are under. Surely we can see that. What is going on in Afghanistan that we are still there after 10 years, we're still in Afghanistan doing what? When $1.4 trillion is harvested and the opium harvest nets 1.2 or 1.3 or greater trillion with a T on an annual basis. I mean, it's insane. It's endless war. The American people were dumbed down because we watch, you know, this is what we get to wrestle with. Who will Chaz Bono dance with? Who will what will happen to Charlie Sheen? Will he implode? What about Wiener's Wiener? Will Britney shave her head again?
What kind of pet will you bring into the White House?
There you go. What kind of pet will you bring into the White House?
And by the way, we've been in Afghanistan as a military for 20 years, since 1991.
Well, yeah, I agree with, you know, the arming the Mujahideen against the Russians. Absolutely. It's lots of opium over there. Somebody's profiting from that.
That came to pretty much an end, and they had found rare earth metals there. And so they really had a legitimate multi-trillion dollar mining operation getting ready to start. And then under our current president, the poppy fields are back. They're back to shipping heroin.
I got to just love it. Well, you know, we need to concern ourselves with, you know, the X factor with Simon Cowell and who will be the winner this year, American Idol, and who will play the Super Bowl. And, you know, and I mean, I take it lightly, but, you know, you look at the number one cable news network, which is Fox, and the number one cable show, which is Bill O'Reilly, and it is nothing more than a circus. It's just entertainment. I mean, he's got the same guests on, and there is no news. I mean, Glenn Beck did this, and it was really funny. It made me wonder. I'm getting a little paranoid here. I did this blog several months ago, and it was about, you know, here were the stories that were being told. We're being told this is when the whole Anthony Weiner scandal was going on. So what are we told? We're being told Anthony Weiner. This is what is all through the media constantly. Anthony Weiner, you know, 24/7. This is it. This is the big story. Well, meanwhile, you know, in the Middle East, the Arab Spring is going on. And what, you know, weigh the stories. What matters? And of course, our media, all the networks lead off with the same story. Anthony Weiner. Meanwhile, the Middle East is imploding. Here's just another example. Fukushima is in meltdown. You don't hear word one about it. You got to dig. You have to dig to find news about Fukushima. It's there. But no one talks about it on any of the major networks. It's okay. Now we find radioactivities in the rice. I mean, how bad is it? 30 times worse than Chernobyl? 300 times worse than Chernobyl? And yet our media is silent about it? It's a managed agenda, as Chuck Missler calls it. And Americans are dumbed down, entertained to death. And, you know, meanwhile, our debt is completely unserviceable. Look, all this was prophesied, and we get into this stuff in Watchers 2. All this stuff was prophesied. I believe that, you know, signs in the heavens and earth. I believe that this stuff was prophesied thousands of years ago. We are now in the window of time where let me just give you a real cogent example of why. Sure, 2,000 years ago, there's this rabbi walking around on the planet, okay? His name is Yeshua. Some people know him by his Greek name, but I digress. The bottom line is that this guy, this man, this rabbi, Yeshua, said that there will be wars and rumors of wars, famines and pestilence, earthquakes in diverse places and troublesome times. Okay, that's great. And he's saying that because that will precede his coming again, okay?
Oh, he says that that men will be lovers of their own selves with unnatural affections.
Yes, yes.
A lot of stuff that's...
A lot of stuff, okay?
But a lot right now.
But here's the point, Brooks. There's no way to track any of that until the modern era. And the case in point is this. We lived 300 years ago, let's say. Here's a scenario. You're a merchant seaman, okay? You've got a company, small company, you got three ships, you sail out of London, you bop down the Thames, you go around the Horn of Africa, you arrive in Japan with all your goods, your ship's loaded. Whoa, you move in the port, and the whole place has been decimated. It's dreadful. There's nothing there. The wharf that you had with your – it's not there. The wharf's not there. Your building's there. Something has just wiped out the city, and you finally, after a week, you find one lone survivor from your company. He says it was a horrible earthquake. You know, we don't know how – but it wiped everything out, and then a huge tsunami wave came in and went 20 miles inland, whatever. Well, okay, you take that account, you take your quill pen and some India ink, and you write on parchment his account. You roll that scroll up, put some sealing wax on it, hop back in your sailing vessel, and take 3 to 4 months, depending on the weather, and how many times you have to pull in the port because of storms or provisions or whatever. You finally get back to England. Now it's 7 months since the event. 7 months since the event. You enroll the scroll, give it to the town crier, and he announces what was written in that scroll, and the information is decimated one voice at a time. Well, in the modern era, for the first time in 2,000 years in all of recorded history, that earthquake happens. We watch it in the speed of live. We're there. We're getting information as it's happening from aerial photography. It's insane. So when this guy is telling us this prophecy 2,000 years ago, when Yeshua is telling us this prophecy 2,000 years ago, there's no way to track it until the modern era. And what we see from my paradigm, from my perspective, okay, we are seeing a 7.0 earthquake almost on a weekly basis. The fish and animal die-offs continue. Marine life, animal life. I mean, it's crazy what's going on. The weather anomalies, the tornadoes, the Category 5 storms, the signs in the heavens with the solar flares coming, Common Elenin, Nibiru. I mean, all these things are taken together. We are in it. In prophetic parlance, it would be called the birth pangs, which is where I believe we are. I mean, these are unprecedented, tenuous, tumultuous times. Combined with that, we see wars and rumors of wars. Look at the Middle East. Who would have ever imagined a year ago that we would see the Arab Spring? No one ever would have imagined. And yet it's happening all at the same time. I believe there's a supernatural trigger behind that. Brooks, I know that might sound crazy to some people.
I've flown a lot of times from Phoenix to Portland, and I've never, ever seen it green. It was green the entire way, and the mountains were full of snow, and the lakes were full of water. And, you know, we have now it's going to snow here in just a few days in Utah on snow from last winter. That has never happened before, not since modern man's been around. We call that a glacier.
Yep, yep.
Now, what's happening with the sun and the moon? I know you got to go here in about 18, 19 minutes, but what's happening with the sun and the moon real quick?
Well, it's interesting. Richard Shaw, my partner and co-producer of the Watcher series, and I did some investigation on the lunar surface. In other words, we called Griffith Observatory, we called JPL, Pepperdine University, UCLA, trying to get some answers, trying to go, hey, guys, is there something wrong with the moon? Are we all crazy? And what we see, and other people saw the same phenomena. It appeared that somehow the moon rotated about 135 degrees. And that immediately go, wait a minute, you know, that just can't happen. We know it rotates. It moves during its waxing and waning. I understand all that. But what we saw, and other people saw the same thing, is something seemed to be affecting the lunar surface. Same thing with the sun. All of a sudden, there are objects in the sun which the SOHO satellites seem to be, whoever's taking these images, are redacting, blacking out images which are in the sun. What are they trying to hide? You know, and then we look at these ejections from the sun. There was one several months ago that went on the other side away from us, but it would have been essentially the movie Knowing. I mean, it probably would have fried the planet had it come on this side, but it didn't. So,
well, it definitely would have shut down the power grids if it was aimed toward Earth. That would have been one that short-circuited some big transformers.
And that's what people don't get. You get a coronal injection like that, and it's basically similar to an EMP, electromagnetic pulse weapon, where the grids go down, and if it's severe enough, the car doesn't start in 2 or 3 days. Everything is toast. Everything is fried. And so, you know, from my paradigm, my worldview, my perspective, we are in the birth pangs that ancient prophetic texts warn us. And guess what, folks? It's not getting better. What's really interesting, Brooks, and I get a lot of flack for this, but there are prophecies that talk about the regathering of the Jews from the four corners of the earth and reestablishing them in their ancient boundaries. And look, I'm not Jewish, so I have no, you know, Jewish axe to grind here. I just don't. But I have a prophetic axe to grind because I'm very much into prophecy. And that prophecy is 2,600 years old. And yet, out of the birth pangs of the Holocaust, what do we see? We see those prophecies literally fulfilled in our time. That's crazy to me. I mean, that's like the Manhattan Indians coming back to Manhattan after only 400 years or whatever and going, hi, we're back. We really like the island back again. That's not going to happen. And what's interesting also about the whole Israeli conundrum is that the land never received the latter rain till the latter part of the 19th century. In other words, you look at pictures from when photography first started to, you know, make its way, 1860, 1865, right around the Civil War time, right? And there's pictures of what's now the Holy Land, right, Israel. And it's denuded. There's nothing there. The Via Della Rosa, which is obviously a tourist trap today, it's like two people standing there. The Dome of the Rock, which is, you know, surrounded by everybody, there's like three people standing there. I mean, the place is empty. No one cares about it. And it's for very specific reasons. Earthquakes plagued the regions. The locusts would come up. If you planted something, the locusts would come up every summer and eat it. And then, of course, the latter rain wouldn't fall. So even if you tried to eke out a living there, you couldn't do it. So the place was denuded. The Turks denuded the place, and there was nothing left. And, of course, all that began to change. Going back to the cosmic chess match, and here's what's really interesting. Really interesting. And I believe that the word Holocaust, this is in my books. I talk about this incessantly. And it's disturbing to some people, but hear me out. The word Holocaust, the German word Holocausting, means a sacrifice, a burnt sacrifice on an altar. A burnt sacrifice on an altar. When the Germans took the Jews, they stacked the bodies like cordwood, and those bodies were thrown into the ovens. And if Hitler had won the war, there'd be no Jew left on the planet, I guarantee you that. Therefore, prophecy wouldn't be fulfilled, and the Most High God is a liar? Is that the end game here? Are we just pawns in this cosmic chess match? The short answer to that for me is, yeah, we are. But what we see is that Hitler doesn't win, and out of the Holocaust, we see prophecy fulfilled as the Jews pour back into Palestine. Other prophecies tell us exactly what is shaping up in the Middle East right now. It's like, you know.
What is going on? Again, we see the perennial push for a Palestinian statehood. Many fear that because the Palestinians would then have a voice in the world court. They would file lawsuits against various generals and presidents around the world for war crimes against them and win. And then when those generals or officials or ambassadors were out and about, say, Germany, France, you know, England, whatever, they're arrested and hauled into court and prosecuted. And that's the sham that they're trying to avoid. Now, the Jews say that they have been trying to negotiate in good faith for 50 years with the Palestinians. And the Palestinians say that's just not true. They're not negotiating with us. It's not negotiations in good faith. You know, they're lobbing thousands of missiles, you know, every other year into Israel. Israel won't let them move, won't let them vote, won't let them, you know, cross in large numbers. And anybody that harbors a suspect, they just bulldoze their house. I mean, they're brutal. They're brutal against each other. And I don't know what's going on over there. You got any feel for it?
Yeah, I do. What we're looking at is two different sets of supernatural events which are at loggerheads with one another. The Jews believe in supernatural events that happened 4,000 years ago. Specifically, let's just take one event, the Passover, where the blood of a lamb is spread on the doors and that angel of death passes over. Right? They said the 4,000-year-old supernatural event. We have to admit, like it or not, it has shaped and colored the body politic of Israel. That's what they adhere to. It is also in shaped and colored the body politic of Christianity. And in this country here, which claims to be a Christian nation, well, where does our Constitution come up with the that all men are created equal and have certain inalienable rights? They're pointing back to the Reformation. They're pointing back to the Bible. Like it or not, you can't get away from it. Well, in Islam, a different set of supernatural events have shaped and colored the body politic. Don't believe me? Look at Saudi Arabia, Sharia law. What is Sharia law based on? It's based on the Prophet Muhammad. It's based on Islam. Look at Iran, which is different because they're Shia. Saudi is Sunni. The Shia in Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, when he spoke this week at the UN, what was he talking about? He was just talking about the Mahdi. That's in their eschatological worldview. They believe in this Imam Mahdi that will come and change everything. And look, what's scary about this is they have apocalyptic fervor here. They really believe this stuff. They believe – so what we're looking at are two separate supernatural events, right? Both of them can't be right, but they are at loggerheads with each other. In addressing the Palestinian issue, I have on record here, and I blogged about this on Friday, there are Jordanian officials high in the government who have gone on the record and stated openly, Palestine is Jordan, Jordan is Palestine. There's no difference. And all this goes back into 47 and 48, and it's a three-hour discussion which we won't get into and certainly not solve here. But I have a theory. I have a theory. And I've posted this and talked about it incessantly. The king of Jordan is a Hashemite king. Right. Hashem is the uncle of Muhammad. The Hashemites hold great sway in the Muslim world and the world of Islam. Both Sunni and Shia respect them because they're descendants of Muhammad. When the Turks lost World War I, the Middle East as we know it was carved up right around the Balfour Declaration and the whole deal. The modern nations of Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq are all newly created nations. And that's why the borders are so bizarre. And the mandate, you know, for Israel at one point was much, much, the land grant given by the Balfour Declaration was much broader than what it is today. And then, of course, it was reduced to before the 67 borders. And then we all know what happened from that. What's interesting is the Hashemite King Abdullah, at one point when we were in Iraq and the Iraqis were forming their constitution, offered to set up a constitutional monarchy in Iraq. Now, they didn't go with that. They have their present constitution, and Maliki is the what I believe a very sort of a figurehead, a puppet, being propped up by U.S. troops. What if, and it's a huge what if, okay, a huge what if, but I've been saying this for about 10 years now. Watch the King of Jordan, because the King of Jordan controls the Temple Mount. He's a Hashemite king. What he could do, and can you imagine if he did this? He'd be heralded as the peacemaker of the millennia. He would be. He would allow Jordan to be governed by the Palestinians. The Palestinians now would have their homeland in Jordan, and Amman would be their capital, not Jerusalem. Do you think the Palestinians would go for that? I think they would. Jordan is populated right now, as we speak, 75% of the population is already Palestinian, which is why they say Jordan is Palestine, Palestine is Jordan. And there, what's interesting also is like, Mahmoud Abbas at the UN, when you look at their logo in the Palestinian charter, it's all of Israel is Palestine. There is no Israel.
Yeah, there's no Israel.
There is no Israel. It's all Palestine. So you got a real problem here because we know that, again, it goes back into two supernatural events that have happened. And this begs the question, Brooks. Here's where I'm coming from. Here, it begs the question, if supernatural events happened before, are they happening now? And my answer is a resounding yes. They're happening all over the place. We just have different ways of interpreting them. I believe the UFO phenomenon is not extraterrestrial, but interdimensional. And I believe that these entities that are there are highly malevolent, in my opinion. And at one point, look, there's a scripture. You get this. There's a prophecy, 2,000-year-old prophecy, which tells us in the very last days there'll be a one-world government. Well, we can see that shaping up. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see it happening right in front of our eyes, right? But it also talks about this mark that everyone will take. And get this. It also talks about a one-world religious system. Well, what singular event would change everything on this planet? It would cause everyone, billions of people, to drop their paradigms. And, of course, I'm speaking of ET disclosure. You see a 3-mile wide – that's the game changer. That, my friend, in my opinion, is the coming great deception. There is a scripture that says that the fallen one will come with all signs and lying wonders, 2,000-year-old prophecy. The fallen one will come with all signs and lying wonders. We are being set up, in my opinion, for the greatest deception – that humankind has ever seen. And these chips that Dr. Lear has removed from people, I believe it plays an integral part with the prophecies. Most of your listeners know about the Mark of the Beast, fine. But what's interesting is there's other prophecies which tie into this mark, which no one's ever discussed. I'll just give you a quick overview. If you take the mark, there's instant judgment. In other words, there is no forgiveness. Well, that seems really harsh. That seems really severe. I don't get that. If you take the mark, grievous sores will appear on your body. Gee, that sounds weird. If you take the mark, get this, it doesn't say this directly, but there's a passage that said men and women will seek death in those days and not find it.
That's
Lear believes, as I do, that this mark – this, whatever this thing is, this chip, is changing the person's DNA. What was happening on the earth? Remember, there's another prophetic text that says, as in the days of Noah will be when the Son of Man returns. So it says that very specifically. What differentiates the days of Noah was extended life, 500, 600, 700, 800, 900 years, right? That's according to the text. What if they show up with two things, Brooks? The first thing is a free energy source, right? Anti-gravity, some kind of anti-gravity device. Wow. Free energy. That changes the world. And then the chip, which will extend your life disease-free for 500 years.
Yeah, I can tell you, if it will return hair, you wouldn't be able to cash the first check. It would be so big. You know, I've said that on this program many times. We are all, well, not all of us, but there is a generation of us that is the Dorian Grays. I mean, we want to be young forever. We will go to Europe and get stem cell treatments to clean up our face, and we'll have, even surgery we'll go to. Anyway, I think that maybe all ETs aren't malevolent. I'm kind of in the, not the fence riding camp, but you know, if there are fallen ones, there are also risen ones, and there has to be opposition in all things. I do think that, you know, global first contact, some large fleet not flying overhead but just landing and having them come out and say, hey, you know, we're here to help. I think that would be a game changer, absolutely. But, you know, part of me is also in the brain-eating alien, you know, side of, you know, the people that put out movies like Skyline and others, where the aliens are here to take over our planet, which is kind of rare on our side of the galaxy. And I think that the human soul is probably one of the most powerful consciousnesses in the universe. We are not like angels. We have choice. We have desire. Our lifespans are so short that we get an incredible amount done and learn an incredible amount in an incredibly short amount of time. We are intelligent, passionate beings full of immense love. We can also display terrible heartlessness. Before you came on, I was running a story about autonomous drones that are now being developed, that are being tested, not in the battlefield, but on experimental. And I really don't believe that. I think they are being tested in the battlefield.
Sure, sure they are.
These are basically set it and forget it drones. You don't have anybody flying them. They're given a set of parameters, and they're released until they're shot down. And it's no loss. It's also no regrets, because they may be going after human targets, and it's a lot less personal when you're programming a drone than when you're standing face-to-face with them, hacking them to pieces with a sword. It's not the same kind of war. It's depersonalized. We call it attrition. We don't call it murder. So it's, we don't care about drones swimming in rivers of blood. It doesn't give us nightmares. So some boy in Alabama can fly a drone in Afghanistan and strafe a funeral procession because it's suspected that terrorists are in it, and feel no qualms about it. He'll go eat his Big Mac that afternoon and be happy as a lark. War has become something antiseptic to us. And, forces are mounting. But we can walk away from that. I strongly believe that. I know you do too. I know that there are more of us than there are of them. And if we want peace, by God, we will have peace.
Well, it remains to be seen. We're living in very unprecedented, tenuous times. I think the place to watch is the Middle East. All eyes should be on Israel, because many of the prophecies which are not fulfilled hinge and revolve around them. And it's coming down. I'm not a prognosticator. I have no idea what we're looking at, but nothing would surprise me at this point. Nothing would surprise me. Who would have imagined the Arab Spring a year ago? None of us would. And, right now, I attended a lecture by Dan Gordon several weeks back at a synagogue. I was probably one of the few non-Jews in the room. Very interesting, because he has dual citizenship, and he's also in the Israeli reserve. And he told us, like, look, here's the deal. For the first time, we have no idea who we're dealing with. And they don't. The Israeli has no idea who they're dealing with. In Egypt, in Jordan, it's all changing. In Syria and Lebanon, they're surrounded by people basically who don't allow them the right to exist at all, for the most part.
That's true. And all my Iranian friends, and I've got a lot of Iranian engineers that I work with from time to time, they don't want this craziness. They don't think the same way that their president does. And I can tell you, Iranians, by and large, are educated people. They're not illiterate like the other Arab nations. They're smart. And they want clean energy, and they want modern cities. They want everything we want, cell phones, cars. They have the freedom to travel anywhere in the world. They're not banned at all. They're not considered a terrorist state. They don't want this war that their president keeps flying around the world talking about.
What's interesting is, and this, again, is a 2,600-year-old prophecy, which talks about a coalition of nations. I mean, this is, if you've never read it, it's worth a read. It's from the book called Ezekiel. It's in the Tanakh, the Old Testament. But it's called Ezekiel, and it's chapter 38. And it lists with great specificity a list of nations which come up against a land of unwalled villages in the latter days. Now, right there, I mean, the hair on the back of your neck should stand up, because in the ancient world, there was no such thing as a land of unwalled villages. It didn't exist. 2,600 right. years ago, when that prophet was writing, no one lived in a land of unwalled villages. But with the advent of the airplane, wow. You know, guess what? The feudal system of large castles with huge walls and moats became moot. No pun intended, because you could fly a plane over and drop a bomb. And so now Israel is a land of unwalled villages regathered from the four corners of the earth. What's interesting is the nations Again, it's not Nostradamus, with all due respect to Nostradamians, with fuzzy quatrains. This is very, very specific. Very specific. It lists the nations which go up against Israel in the latter days. And it says that. In the latter days. I mean, how much more specific? After they've been regathered.
It describes the effects, or at least from their standpoint, the effects of the weapons.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you read Ezekiel 38 and 39, what's going on there is really bizarre. But the second nation is Persia. And we all know that Persia is Iran. I mean, only in the modern era did they change the name of Persia, which was thousands of years old, to Iran. It's like us going, well, we're going to call it Cape Kennedy instead of Cape Canaveral. Same place, same location, same stuff goes on, same thing with Iran and Persia. It's listed 2,600 years ago as Persia. It's the second nation that's listed. The first nation is Magog. Many of us believe that that, of course, is Russia. And we see Russia's hands all over the Middle East right now, all over the Middle East. So all I'm saying is that here's prophecy that means that some being is outside our space-time continuum that can see the future in ways that we can't, and already has written it and told us exactly what's going to come to pass. So it's no surprise to me that I see, you know, Persia or Iran shaking hands with Russia. Remember, the Ruskies were the guys that put the fuel rods in the Iranian reactor a year ago. So it's shaping up. Are we there yet? No. But the stage is being set for that prophecy, which is 2,600 years old, to be fulfilled. And I find that disturbing, chilling, alarming.
Let's connect the dots a little bit here. I mean, the Nephilim are the planners. They're the ones that are ancient and been here, are holding influence over these world leaders. It's their plan. They're the ones that are bringing these world nations against this one nation. It's not God's plan to put all these nations at war with one another. It's someone who's designing that war. He just foresaw it and wrote about it. So if they're still here, if they're still running things, it's clear that their plan is unfolding like clockwork. I mean, the world economy is now down to three currencies. It won't be long before we have two. And, all it takes is one of those two to go bankrupt and you'll have one. And, gee, I just heard that this morning on the news. So, we have those forces lining up exactly as planned. Mm-hmm. These ancient beings that are timeless, and I won't call them eternal, but they live incredibly long times, 30, 40,000 years, they're underground and they're influencing these leaders with their plan. And if it fails, they work it again. They come at it from another angle and another one. And it's unfolding just the way they planned it.
Well, I would, I hear where you're coming from. And they are, the end game is unfolding. Probably we have a slightly different take on that. I believe that they're, this benevolent, all-seeing God type of guy, whatever you want to call him. But, the Jews called him Yahweh. For practical purposes, let's just call it God. He's writing this telling us what is going to happen. It is etched in stone, which is really bizarre for us to think that it's like he gets in the whole thing of predestination. And it's like, you mean we have no free will? Oh, yeah, we got tons of free will choice. It's just that he's already seeing this and telling us what's going to happen. I do agree with you that there are dark, malevolent, supernatural forces that are goading and pushing this thing to happen. That much I do agree with you. Yeah. And it's a nasty time.
That reason that those things were written down is to empower us so that we have the choice to choose another future. Because, we physicists believe in the potential of all potentialities. We don't have to walk down this path. We're choosing to walk down this path.
Well, what's interesting is, and I hear what you're saying, is it choice? And it's kind of like Groundhog's Day with Bill Murray, it's just over and over and over again until he gets it right. And I wish it was that way in some respect. But what we see is that it's unfolding just like these prophetic texts tell us it will in the latter days, which, again, I find very disturbing, very alarming. But from my perch, that's what I see.
It is. I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's some action here. Can you stay another half hour?
You know, I really can't. We've been on for an hour and a half. I've got dinner to make, and okay. I got to get going.
All right. I really, really appreciate you coming on. Now, we didn't have any calls because there are thousands of listeners out there going, no, don't call in. Don't call in. Just let them keep going. That's what we're doing. L.A., it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. And
love to come back on, Brooks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, when Mistress 3 comes out, shoot it to me because I'm hooked now on your films. They're just so good.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Tell our listeners one more time how to get them.
If you're interested at all, you can go to lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net, and apprise yourself of the Watchers DVDs. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. It's a great way to wake people up. You can invite a bunch of people over to your house, pop some popcorn, and let those babies go, and watch the conversation fly at the end, because everybody's going to be – that's all we're trying to do. Wake people up. Something's going on. It's not business as usual. That's what Watchers is about. Brooks, thanks so much for having me on. And it's once again, the website is lamarzulli.net.
All right. Thank you so much, LA. Have a good dinner. Have a great week. We'll talk to you
all
another
right.
time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, listeners, what we're going to do now is take a quick break. We'll do a little Muse Uprising, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio. You don't want to miss this. Oh, my gosh. The uprising is just beginning. Be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. Our AccuWindow forecast, 72 degrees and peaceful. Sunday's football was awesome. Don't report on that here. You have to watch the reruns for yourself. Muse with Uprising giving us our bump for this hour. We really appreciate you being here with us. By the way, the phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. And 530-413-4511, anywhere on planet or off planet. Those of you listening on the conference line at 760-569-7676, you must have dialed the passcode 192919. And you're enjoying the program. I know L.A. Marzulli is always always a challenge to have on the program because he brings such ideas that really arouse our faculties and get us thinking about things in a deep and poignant manner. By the way, I just want to let you know that the satellite did plunge to the ground yesterday or Friday. They're not really sure where it landed, but there is some pretty compelling video out there in Italy. Just, you know, person on the street video, doing a video interview of a nice-looking lady with the Mediterranean in the background, and off to the right of him, left of her, the sirens begin, and they swing the camera over, and there in broad daylight you have these bright things descending to the ocean. They panic and shut off the camera and run, so I assume they're running. I also want to let you know that the presidential debates that occurred the other night, I believe it was Thursday night, quite fascinating stuff. Just really powerful, I thought. Yeah, it might be a big stage show, but there's some new ideas. There's some fresh forces out there. And Herman Cain winning the straw poll in Florida is about to turn history on its head. One of two things is going to happen. Either Herman Cain is going to win the presidency, as all Florida straw polls have predicted, or for the first time in presidential prognosticating history, the Florida straw poll winner is not going to win the presidency. One thing is for sure, the press is not giving Ron Paul very much airtime at all. He sits up there behind the microphone with kind of a happy smile on his face because he knows that the online community is behind him by about a 25% margin. And most people that have computers, cell phones, smartphones, or other devices to access the web are following his platform. And it is exactly what America needs right now. Now, the interesting thing about, you know, Mr. Johnson and his comments are they're right on the money, just not enough. It's too little too late. But interesting stuff that my next-door neighbor's two dogs have created more shovel-ready jobs than this administration. It might go back a little bit before Obama, but the idea that government can, with the snap of a finger and the flash of a pen, begin creating jobs was certainly shot down. So our good friend Diane is on the phone from Michigan. Diane, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Brooks. How are you this evening?
I'm doing wonderful.
Wonderful. Brooks, I was very curious, and you hadn't covered this tonight, seeing all of the internet talk that's going on this week about the recesses from the governments around the world in the fact of Elanin on the 26th and 27th coming between the sun and the earth. And I was surprised that you had not mentioned anything about that, and I was curious to find out what you thought about that.
Well,
Obama's in Denver, and they're putting out this decon exercise. Our Senate and Congress are recessed now, and they just came back from vacation.
Well, we covered it for about 6 weeks while the head was still corporal, that is, altogether. And I maintained that it was a comet, although it came from a different part of the galaxy that we're used to. The Oort cloud is normally where we see things come from. But that if it was a comet, when it got within the sun's range, it would start off-gassing. If it got hot enough, the head would come apart and the whole thing would dissolve. And that's exactly what happened. It started off-gassing, the head came apart and dissolved, and Elenin is no more. That doesn't mean that it's not a gaseous cloud out
there
20
million
miles away.
Well, could it be something else? I mean, what is the reasoning behind the UK, the Pope, Germany, South America, our Senate, our Congress, and Obama being in Denver underground? Is this just propaganda out there or what?
Yeah, it probably is. I don't think Obama's underground. He wasn't as of a few hours ago. There is a asteroid
in several newspapers.
Yeah, but there's an asteroid coming next, actually in November, the 9th of November. That's really the one we should be worried about. MU55 is going to come between the moon and the Earth. That's how close it's going to come. And
okay, I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think Elenin is a type, an archetype. I think it's just an alert to get us ready.
So you think that Richard C. Hoagland's theory is not correct?
Right. There's nothing to worry about there, at least from Elenin. Comet Elenin broke up and is nothing more than a flatulent out there in space right now. But that doesn't mean there aren't other near-Earth objects to worry about. I will tell you that
What about Nibiru?
Nothing planet-sized on the horizon. There are more free-floating planets than there are planets revolving around suns. I will tell you that. That's a statistical fact. But nothing planet-sized in the neighborhood of our solar system right now other than those things that are currently in orbit. That being said, 2 weeks ago on Wednesday, the Near-Earth Orbit Task Force met again in Pasadena. And they were going over, this is the third time that they've met in less than 3 years. And they now have a budget and a plan, and they are going to go after some near-Earth objects and test either blowing one up or hooking some rockets to it and moving it out of the way, moving its trajectory. They are serious about starting to watch big near-Earth objects now. And we have enough amateurs out there with some really, really good equipment. Some even have radio antennas out there. And they're watching for near-Earth objects. So I feel pretty safe that one's not going to sneak up on us. That's my take on it.
Interesting to everything that's out there right now that's being put out there on the Internet, which I don't, obviously, I have to do my research on most of those things. That's why I was calling you. And the other thing is when I get an X Squared Radio, Brooks, I wanted to take a look at your telescopes, and I can't seem to locate them.
You can't look at my telescope?
No, I can't seem to locate them in your store.
Oh, yeah, well, you have to. I actually stopped carrying the telescopes because the people that were supplying the telescopes stopped paying me. So right now I have enough subscribers to the archives, I don't have to run commercials. But if I was going to buy a telescope, I would either go to the Discovery Store, which we used to run ads for, but they never paid us any commissions.
Is that on your website?
It isn't anymore. No, we don't do free advertisement. I just don't clutter up the site with free ads anymore. So if people are going to advertise with me, it costs $25 a week. But if you don't pay, I'm going to kick you off the website. And that's what happened. They didn't pay,
right.
So we kicked off.
So, Brooks, give me some type of a direction on what to go for a first-time buyer in a telescope.
Okay. I would highly recommend a solar telescope. They're affordable. They're portable. You can pack it away really easy. It is called a Coronado scope. You can buy them on eBay. They're about $500 or $600. And let me tell you, once you look at the sun through one of these things, it's like nothing you've ever seen. Photographs do not do it justice. You have to look at it through one of these scopes. You'll be amazed. You'll do it every day. It's so amazing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much
for
calling.
Thank you, and have a good evening.
All right. Bye-bye, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Now, we've been running alerts on X Squared Radio for a few months now, and I was able to get the message directly to Congress face to face recently. Here is the core of the alert, okay? The EPA is continuously driving jobs overseas. But even more shocking is that the EPA is directly increasing the pollution of the earth by heavily taxing emerging technology designed to lower emissions. In some cases, the cost of the technology has been driven so high by these taxes, and these are not congressional taxes, these are taxes directly from the EPA, that it has become impossible to produce in America. The cost of the technology has been driven so high it cannot be produced in America. In some cases, the technology providers have refused to take the jobs overseas. In other words, if they can't build it in the U.S., they're not building it. They have chosen bankruptcy over treason against the American citizen. Listen very closely to this Fox News report. I think it's going to tell you the story. It is tremendously telling. I'm going to play it just the way it is, and then I'm going to give you some evidence to go with it. Don't go away. Listen very closely.
Republican Congressman Morgan Griffith of Virginia is the co-sponsor of the bill to delay the new boiler rooms, and he joins us now. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Give the viewers a sense of what was at stake, or what's at stake with this, with both of these rules.
Well, what's at stake is lots of jobs. We don't know how many, but clearly thousands of jobs are in jeopardy as a result of new rules being put forward by the EPA. The EPA stayed two of the four that are included in what's called Boiler Mac. We have a bill that says, okay, we're going to give you more time, like the courts, with the EPA asked the courts for. We're going to give you more time, and we're going to stretch out the time that companies have to comply with whatever the rules are. We believe that it's the right thing to do because we want to make sure we get these rules right. These are new regulations coming on businesses. We want to make sure we don't force more jobs overseas in the process of having new regulations. The regulations may be necessary in some cases. We want to take a look at that and make sure that's accurate. But we don't want to do that quickly when we know that the job losses will be irreversible, that the expenses that the businesses have to put into their companies if they stay in the United States will be irreversible. And if we come down the road and 6 months, 8 months later, we find out that's not correct, we have a big problem in this country.
Congressman, let me play devil's advocate here, because I understand the importance of getting this right. But at the same time, the number one thing that plagues this economy and plagues this market is uncertainty, whether it's regulation that's going to take over healthcare, whether it's about what's happening in Europe, even GDP growth. And certainly these EPA regulations don't help anything. Isn't Congress part of the problem here as well in terms of delaying any sort of outcome? In the meantime, businesses are frozen, and that's costing everybody money.
Okay, I'm going to stop it right here because actually that's not true. Congress oversees the EPA, but the EPA writes its own regulations. The process they use is they sue. They bring lawsuits against companies knowing that they can win, and they're very, very careful about the lawsuits that they enjoin, knowing that they can win, and they do it in a specific way so that it builds precedent so that they can use it to write their own regulations. They are also enacting their own taxes and fees and fines, and this is above and beyond anything Congress does or is aware of. I know this because I spoke to the congressman myself. Let's keep going.
Well, I don't think there's any question in a perfect world we'd have everything, you know, instantly available. But unfortunately, this is very complex. There are over 100 pages of federal regulations in the proposals that were put out last winter, spring. The EPA itself recognized they needed to relook at about half of the regulations they put out. So there's
now, that was the key. The EPA itself needed to look at half the regulations that they put out. These regulations are not being put out by Congress. I repeat, they are not being put out by Congress. They're being put out by the EPA on their own accord. By the way, this is called taxation without representation. Let's continue.
Doing that now, and in all fairness, I believe that long term we need to make sure we get it right, that you know, certainty but wrong means we force businesses out of the country. We even had one business from my district who came in and testified and said that if, you know, they're not given a longer time period, they would have to significantly reduce the workforce that they had in the 9th District of Virginia.
Now, that's important that he said he had businesses coming in and testifying. I know for a fact that businesses are asked to come to Washington. They have to pay their own way there. They don't get any special favors. They're not getting access. They come in and they testify what these regulations are doing to their industry specifically. This is how Congress gains their information. Congress can then go back and write laws curtailing the EPA. But I got to tell you, they're two steps behind. Let's continue.
Because they can't make the changes that the EPA would want in the time period that the EPA has allowed.
So what sort of time frame are you looking for, Congressman? I mean, I know that you're looking to delay this at least for 15 months, but there's a lot on Congress's plate. In the meantime, this seems like something that could continue to get pushed out further and further.
Well, if the bill passes, and I believe it'll pass the House, and I hope it will pass the Senate, because the language is bipartisan language, both Democrats and Republicans. We have 24 Democrats, 117 total sponsors in the House, similar numbers proportionally in the Senate, and it looks like it's got some real possibility of support. We believe if it passes, it will give businesses the ability to realize that at the very least they're going to have more time to adjust to these regulations. We're not saying we've got to rewrite the entire law, but we do need to rewrite this portion of the law so that businesses will have more time so that they can appreciate and figure out what they can do.
Right.
For example, the one employer I mentioned earlier, they don't have a supply of natural gas that's sufficient to flip over to natural gas in that area. Engineering natural gas in there is going to take time.
Congressman, you know, I must commend you for trying to take the subtle route, because from what I've read, cement industry experts say up to 20,000 jobs could be lost, and a boiler industry up to 200,000 jobs. Now, here's the thing I'm concerned about. Are you in Congress, your members on both sides of the aisle, worried that your authority is being usurped by czars and the EPA, and that you really had no sort of say in this sort of decision that will obviously cost American jobs, and we'll probably see imports of cement as opposed to exports of cement?
Now that was the question of the interview. Are you being usurped by the czars inside the EPA? The answer is yes. The answer is yes, they are being circumvented. And we, the American people, are being circumvented by the EPA. But I want you to listen to the congressman's answer. You call in, tell me if you think he answered it correctly.
There's no question in regard to Cement Mac and many of these other products that are being made that we will see greater imports, because they're going to make it impossible to make some of these products in the United States. And I think it's very clear in the Cement Mac area that evidence is fairly clear.
But sir, are you concerned that your authority in Congress is that you guys are losing sway and with the political conversation and major decisions in this country? Do you think perhaps that's being taken away from you?
Now, again, he asked the question. It isn't important whether the cement industry, by the way, they're great polluters in the sense that they put out a lot of CO2. But if we don't make cement in this country, they're just going to make cement in another country. And I guarantee you those plants will put out even more CO2 than our plants put out. Our plants are cleaner. They're more contained. They're mostly in remote areas. And the CO2 actually is not a pollutant. It is naturally metabolized by plants. That's not the important part. The important part is that Congress is being usurped. Agencies like the EPA are writing their own laws. Let's see if he answers it again.
Well, I am concerned about that, and you just mentioned Solyndra, and that's an area where apparently they made a legal ruling that I think doesn't make any sense in order to subordinate the American taxpayer. That is true across the board. We see a lot of decisions being made by the Obama administration that are taking away or just making decisions without Congress being involved. That being said, I'm not really sure I can say that about Boiler Mac or Cement Mac. They're following court rulings and prior legislative intent. I may not agree with the court rulings, but I do think that Congress is involved in this process.
Now, I told you that they use the court rulings to establish precedent so that they can move their agenda forward. How you choose these cases is very, very critical. You, first of all, you choose cases you can win. Second of all, because if you lose, that also sets a precedent. Second of all, you choose the cases that have the theme along the line that you want to win on. And you assemble these precedents to help you formulate your legislation or your regulations. Now, the legislation is in place by Congress that allows the EPA to use court decisions to make these rules. That is the fundamental core of what needs to be changed. But again, the congressman did not answer the question. We'll continue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Congressman Morgan Griffith of Virginia. We appreciate it.
All right. So there you have it. That is the congressman from Virginia telling the story. Now, let's talk about the real world. Electric vehicles are now taxed by the EPA the same as though they were gasoline-powered vehicles, which will double the price to the American consumer. If you want to buy an electric vehicle, you must buy it in another country. The new tax has killed 50,000 jobs in the U.S. and driven the entire electric vehicle industry into bankruptcy. Quote, the Obama administration's environmental policies appear to be aimed at destroying, and I'm going to read you several of these quotes from other industries, at destroying the cattle industry in America as we know it. It is ironic that as we work to become less dependent on foreign oil, Obama's policies are likely to make us more dependent on foreign beef. EPA is waging an unprecedented war to end modern production of animal agriculture. EPA exhibits reckless indifference to scientific fact and instead imposes stringent regulations based on nothing more than its biased anti-animal agriculture agenda that will leave many cattle operations with no recourse but to shut down and eliminate jobs. And that's from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Let's listen to another one from Virginia. Farmers and their way of life and livelihood have never felt more challenged or threatened than they do today by the continuous onslaught of regulations and requirements from the Environmental Protection Agency. The cost they represent will impact the economy as a whole, and this committee should not be surprised when our economy contracts and jobs are lost to foreign competition. That's the Virginia Farm Bureau Federation. Now, another industry. Why has an American agency decided to declare regulatory war on such a large swath of American people? We're here today because we need your help to stop this regulatory runaway train before it causes irreparable damage to America's heartland by raising our cost of operation and making American farmers uncompetitive in the world marketplace. That's the national sorghum producers. Now, let's listen to another one. The EPA has put together a well-coordinated plan to eliminate coal mining in the Appalachian region. Why is the EPA working so hard to put Appalachian coal producers out of business? Why are they applying rules and regulations to only one industry in five states of Appalachia? Why are they willing to sacrifice 80,000 jobs in this economically depressed region? Why are they attempting to eliminate coal as an energy source at a time when America needs inexpensive and reliable domestic sources of energy more than ever? And that's the U.S. Coal Corporation. It gets worse. It gets worse. Do you have asthma? Do you have an inhaler in your purse or book bag? Are your kids able to play sports like normal kids because they carry an inhaler with them at all times? Has your life been saved by an inhaler? Well, that's about to come to an end, thanks to the EPA. Remember how Obama recently waived new ozone regulations at the EPA because they were too costly? Well, it seems that the Obama administration would rather make people with asthma cough up money than let them make a surely inconsequential contribution to the depleting of the ozone layer. Asthma patients who rely on over-the-counter inhalers will need to switch to prescription-only alternatives as part of the federal government's latest attempt to protect the Earth's atmosphere. The Food and Drug Administration said Thursday patients who use the epinephrine inhalers to treat mild asthma will need to switch by December 31st to other types that do not contain CFCs, an aerosol substance once found in a variety of spray products. The action is part of an agreement signed by the U.S. and other nations to stop using substances that deplete the ozone layer, a region in the upper atmosphere that helps block harmful ultraviolet rays from the sun. But the switch to a greener inhaler will cost consumers some green as well. Epinephrine inhalers are available via online retailers for around $20, whereas the alternatives, which contain the drug albuterol, range from $30 to $60. One piece of testimony you need to hear. Listen closely. They already took the CFCs out of prescription inhalers and rendered them nearly useless despite higher cost. Before they changed them, an inhaler would last my son 3 weeks and actually control his asthma. The new ones last a week, and he uses his nebulizer machine at least once a day as well. I get protecting the ozone layer, but try explaining that to a 14-year-old who can't play sports or keep up with his friends because he can't breathe. There is something you can do. This is the EPA we need to get rid of. There is a resolution that you can sign. Of course, you need to change the words in it to fit your personal situation. But if there are any asthma sufferers out there who have an inhaler, who have gone to the prescription version of albuterol or bought one over the counter, whether you live in Egypt, whether you live in Israel, whether you live in Georgia or Chile, you can't buy them anymore. They're gone because of the EPA. Now, the host, me, Brooks Agnew, suffered from asthma from age 5 years old until I was 52. Those 47 years, I carried an inhaler with me. If I exercised, if I ran up a flight of stairs, if I went out for a football, if I went to play frisbee, if I walked too fast playing golf, my lungs shut down like I was trying to climb stairs while breathing through a drinking straw. Of course, that ended in August of 2006. But those 47 years, I remember very, very clearly. And I know what it's like to sit there with your eyes popping out of your head while you're trying to catch your breath. It's like drowning. Obviously, nobody in the EPA has asthma. All right, here's the resolution. We, the people of the United States of America, and the subject is the scientifically, medically, and morally unjustifiable ban of CFC, that's chlorofluorocarbons, asthma, COPD, and cystic fibrosis inhalers by the FDA, pursuant to the Montreal Protocol and the U.S. Clean Air Act. I'm going to read the resolution to you. You can listen to it on the archive, or you can skip through it if you want, but it's important because you need to know the facts. Whereas there is no evidence that the small amounts of CFC inhaler emissions were capable of perceptibly depleting the ozone layer, increasing ground-level UVB radiation levels, or causing an increase in the incidence of skin cancer. Whereas the EPA itself admitted that CFC inhalers were banned not because they themselves posed any threat to the environment, but only for political expediency. Whereas just 4 space shuttle flights do more damage to the ozone layer than all the CFC inhaler emissions generated by U.S. patients during an entire year at peak usage, and there has been no attempt to ban or minimize any military or civilian rocket launches due to the concerns about ozone depletion. Whereas FDA's own MedWatch data clearly shows that CFC inhalers are much safer than the replacement HFA. These are the hydrofluoroalkane inhalers. Whereas the FDA never provided the legally required U.S. post-marketing data for Proventil HFA and Ventolin HFA, establishing the safety and effectiveness of these HFA replacement inhalers prior to the ban of CFC albuterol inhalers, rendering their decision to ban CFC albuterol inhalers fraudulent and illegal. Whereas the HFA-134A propellant gas was never tested by itself in asthma and pulmonary patients. It was only tested in animals. Okay? Volunteers do not have inflamed hyperactive airways and severe allergies. Many physicians believe that their asthma, COPD, and cystic fibrosis patients are allergic to the HFA propellant gas itself. Whereas the HFA inhalers usually contain com-source ethanol as a solvent, and it has been clearly established that inhaled ethanol and or com residue can actually cause bronchoconstriction. In other words, it shuts your lungs down. It's what happens to you after you take a slug of Everclear and then try to breathe. Got it? These inactive ingredients should never have been included in an emergency medical device intended to prevent bronchoconstriction. Whereas some of the many inactive ingredients and impurities in the HFA inhalers are responsible for the decreased safety and effectiveness of these replacement inhalers. Whereas it is clearly established that the replacement HFA inhalers tend to clog easily, even when they are meticulously cleaned, and they clog when wet or damp. It is not always possible for asthmatics to schedule their asthma attacks for dry weather, nor is it always possible for them to schedule their asthma attacks for those times when the HFA replacement inhalers have finished air drying after their frequently required cleaning. Many physicians, nurses, and other medical professionals agree with us that HFA inhalers are not nearly as safe and effective as the banned CFC inhalers. It has been clearly established that the leading allergy and pulmonology medical associations and nonprofit asthma and COPD patient advocate organizations have severe conflicts of interest on the subject of CFCs versus HFA inhaler. Now, you got to listen to this. That means that they're invested in the companies that create the HFA inhalers. The FDA approved the ban of CFC inhalers without mandating that the replacement HFA inhalers undergo large-scale, long-term, real-world U.S. post-marketing studies to ensure the safety of 40 million Americans who rely on these inhalers, despite their own admissions that such studies were needed to ensure patient safety. Therefore, we, the undersigned, demand that the U.S. government amend the Clean Air Act to provide for the immediate and permanent legalization of all previously approved CFC inhalers. Further, we demand that the President of the United States issue any executive orders necessary to provide the fastest possible manufacture and distribution of CFC inhalers in this country on an emergency basis, in order to minimize patient death, disability, and suffering. Finally, we demand that the President issue an executive order that would provide for the legal importation of foreign CFC inhalers and domestic production is reestablished. First, you can't work because of the EPA taxing or fining clean, renewable, emerging technologies out of existence, and now you can't even breathe. We have a chance to do something more about it. Let's clean the house. Let's clean the White House and get someone like Herman Cain or Ron Paul or Carl Johnson or Newt Gingrich in office. Plan to vote, please. I am constantly on this program trying to bring a positive light on the things that can affect our world. I wish I could find something positive about the motivations of the EPA trying to continue its climb to ultimate power over the industry. So where did the EPA come from? How did it get started? It was born in the wake of elevated concern about environmental pollution. The EPA was established on December 2, 1970 to consolidate in one agency a variety of federal research, monitoring, standard setting, and enforcement activities to ensure environmental protection. Since its inception, EPA has been working for a cleaner, healthier environment for the American people. I'm sure. William Ruckelshaus was the first EPA administrator. Stopped DDT. Russell Train, 1973 to 1977, added catalytic converters to cars. Douglas Costell served from 1977 to 1981, started the Superfund to clean up toxic waste dumps like Love Canal. Ann Gorsuch was the next EPA secretary from 1981 to 1983, got asbestos out of the schools and cleaned up Times Beach. William Ruckelshaus again served from 1983 to 1985 and began opening up the agency with transparency efforts. Lee Thomas, 1983 to 1989, removed lead from gasoline, sulfur from coal, and he's the one that signed the Montreal Protocol to eliminate CFCs. William Riley served 1989 to 1993, signed treaties to end acid rain. Carol Brower, 1993 to 2001, the longest acting head. She established brownfields regulation, ended lead paint, and stopped the construction of refineries. Christine Todd Whitman, 2001 to 2003, tried to revitalize abandoned industrial sites. Her watershed programs began encroaching on private citizens and backyards everywhere. Michael Levitt served from 2003 to 2005 and cleaned up the Great Lakes, but focused on winnable court cases that would build precedents, allowing them to write their own regulations. Stephen Johnson served from 2005 to 2009. Junk science gutted the biodiesel industry, publishing false and misleading reports that canola oil was more polluting than petroleum in making diesel fuel. In addition, he issued the ruling that biodiesel was not fuel, but rather an additive, making it impossible for service stations to blend biodiesel with diesel fuel at the pump. He also established a final ruling that forced the removal of alcohol from the formula by requiring 90% more energy be applied to the compound. This increased the cost of biodiesel so that it could not compete with petroleum at the pump until the price reached $5 a gallon. Lisa Jackson served from 2009 until now and currently supports both junk science and strategic litigation to build their own regulations and fund their own bureaucracy from billions in fines and fees charged to American businesses. Under her watch, tens of millions of asthmatics were put at the risk of death by outlawing the production of OTC inhalers worldwide. Electric vehicle taxes enacted by the EPA have made them prohibitively expensive. I don't know how to put a positive spin on that except to end it. So I'm with Herman Cain. I'm with Newt Gingrich. Eliminate the EPA. Start over. Congress, do your job and take control of an agency that has run amok. They have gone crazy. They're driving us to the point where we will all be consumers and producing nothing. Except without jobs, who are we going to work for? Oh, yeah, that's right. See something, say something. I guess we all work for the federal government now, don't we? See you next week, right here on X Squared Radio.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.